call the conference committee together for House File 392. And I thought the first thing we could do is run through the quick introduction so everybody knows where everybody else is and or has time to forget. And so we want to do, you know, the front row of staff and revenue and everybody at the table. So maybe we can just start with Ms. Templin.
Nina Manzi, House Research. I work on the individual income tax.
Joel Michael, House Research.
Karen Baker, House Research.
Al Junkie from Canyoy County.
I'm Randy Demmer from Dodge County and part of Olmsted County, District 298.
Lyle Clooney, District 20B, Chippewa County, Rendell County, Eastern Illinois.
Paul Marquardt, District 9B, all of Wilkin and Traverse County and parts of Clay and Becker County, and we're awful wet in my area right now.
We're thinking of Representative Marquardt, and we're glad to see Senator Scroggs make his way in. I'm Ann Lejeune, I represent Bloomington, and nice to be with you again, Chair Bach.
Tom Black, Senate District 6, which is most of the Arrowhead region. We still have snow on the ground, and we're getting some more today.
Rochefoy, Senate District 2. When my son, I talked to him last night, he said the water in the Clearwater River is touching our bridge. A lot of water.
Rick Wolfing from Senate District 17, which is always just Osceola, Multi-Lake Shanty, and part of the Multi County.
State Senator Scott Dibble. The district is almost completely covered by Green Acres. So. Southwest Minneapolis and downtown Minneapolis.
Joanne Zock from Senate Council.
Mark Hasty from Senate Council.
Susan Brown Marshall from Senate Council
Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to move in there that we should find? Well, Julie's right there. So, Julie, you want folks to know where you are there?
Stand up. We might be on TV. Your mother's here.
Okay, thank you, Julie. And we've got one more senator to introduce us. Senator Bach was just trying to make the minority senators move out of this building, and I don't know if Senator Olstein wanted to go to the Ford building. Welcome, Senator Vandeveer. Can you tell us who you are and where you represent? Just get started.
Vandeveer, Forest Lake, first-term state senator, 5 terms in the House. Represent northern Washington County and northeastern Milford County.
Great. Well, thank you all. And I want to first apologize for the room. Ms. Carlton Walrus got the best, biggest room she could get. As you know, we're running up on policy deadlines, and both the House and Senate, all the big rooms are taken. So we're putting pressure on Chris over here to see if they can get us not as tight of a room for tomorrow unless we get done tonight, Senator Bach. Which I think we could get done tonight, Senator Bach.
Doctor, I'm just wondering, you'll notice the makeup of the Senate Conference Committee has inner city, Minneapolis, ex-urban, rural. I'm just wondering, the House side seems a little slanted rural, but it's, what we have.
You mean with Lenchowski?
I just noticed that.
Senator Bach, the Senate members, or the House members in both parties, no matter where they reside, understand that federal conformity has to get done immediately. All of it. And
really?
So beyond that, if there are other issues, I have incredible confidence in the House conference to come out with a good position on
this issue. Madam Chair, if somehow this committee comes to some resolve and signs a conference committee report and there's some version of a Green Acres provision in here, because this is a House file, will the House take credit for resolving kind of the Green Acres angst that's out there just because it happens to be a House file? Will they send out letters to the paper saying the House fixed this?
Well, I'll ask other House conferees what they'll do. I won't. I'll say Senator Bach fixed it. Okay. Well,
since I've been out state doing it every day for every day around the state, the only people I've seen take credit so far are senators, particularly Senator Scoy, who's got Collins and half the paper. Just a
reference. And they're back. We brought our own senator to the conference committee this time. I think you just got to play with that.
Exactly.
Some people don't have to be in the Senate to understand how that works. I think this will be a great group of people. And this, you know, we're kidding around, but both of these issues are very serious issues, and we need them both resolved. So we want to get full conformity absolutely as quickly as we can, and we want to solve the Green Acres issues. And Senator Bach and I have talked about that, and I think we're both committed to doing that. So we want to just get started and get moving on that. I thought we would start with Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael. I believe it would be the right people to walk through the, or maybe Ms. Manzi, right here, yeah. And did Ms. Flamash want to join? I'm not sure who's going to. Please, yeah. So we're going to go through the federal conformity. Senator Bach and I talked about this a little bit last night. We'd like to get through that. We want to hear from the Department of Revenue. Who are these folks who the Senate is not done conformity on that are being affected. Then we'd like to get through Green Acres. So we're going to ask, again, both sides here to walk through the Green Acres. And we'd like to get that all done today as quickly as we can. And then we'd like to begin negotiations today as we are under the gun on both of these. I think that we need to take a break about 4. We have 2 senators who have to have bills up in various places. So we're going to recess and come back as soon as they can get their bills through their committees. And then we'll just keep going. So people who want to get a bite to each should do that when we take that break, wherever they can around here. I do want to just, before we start with staff here, is just say that I think there's only Senator Olstein who does not have the pleasure of being a House member. But do you have any insights you want to provide for us on that?
I was so grateful when Representative Kalin ran for the House and I ran for the Senate.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. So, where should we start? Ms. Hanby, please. Well, we've got this in our corners, I believe. If you can direct us to what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, Nina Hanby, Health Research. Mr. Hasty and I put together something that's a little bit different from the standard side-by-side. It's really good. And rather than going through section by section, it sort of hits the main topics inside of federal conformity and indicates what the 2 bills do on the topic. The first topic is the date that we're updating to the federal code to, and the House is updating to all federal changes through December 31st, 2008. After that, the summary list of the major bills we're updating to. These are all the federal bills that have been enacted since the adjournment last session, with the exception of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, which was enacted after House Bill 392 passed the House floor.
And can I just say, I think because we really do want to try to get this done as quickly as we can, we're going to pass all the things that we're in agreement on, and I know others may be interested in them, but we're going to skip over them and just get to where we're disagreeing. So, please, yes. Welcome.
My name is Mark Hasty, the Senate Counsel, Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee. We agree with the dates here. We disagree with the dates. June 17th is the date the Senate conforms to. However, on the other provisions, the HEAL Earnings Assistance Tax Relief Act, we do agree with the House on that. On the Housing Assistance Tax Act, there are actually 3 sections which we conform to, one of them which was not listed here, sections 3012, 3023, and I should add section 3022, paragraph 8, if we add that to that section. So those are what we do conform to, and we don't conform to the rest. The Housing Assistance Tax Act. The Senate version does not conform to the Heartland Habitat Harvest and Horticultural Act, enacted June 18th. And for the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, we conform to Division C, sections 202, 203, and 204, but none of the rest of the sections of that act.
The next section in the summary the high points on the federal law changes. I'm not going to go through them. It's on pages 1, 2, 3, and 4. So these bullet points list all the items that directly affect Minnesota taxpayers that were contained in those 4 pieces of federal legislation enacted through the end of last session. The bottom of page 4 has a heading for major federal changes that we're not conforming to that will require additions on the Minnesota individual income tax return. Both the House and the Senate will require an addition for the new additional amount added to the standard deduction for property taxes. And then moving to the top of page 5, both in the House and the Senate are going to require an addition for the tuition expense deduction. So we're disallowing that extension of that item that the federal government enacted. The House requires an addition for the enhanced deduction of contributions of computers. This follows along with what we did last year regarding the same deduction, which has since been extended by the federal government. And then we require an addition for the extension of additional subpart debt income exclusion. And the Department of Revenue has pointed out that there's a technical error on our language on that item that would need to be corrected in a conference committee report if this were to be adopted.
Chair members, I'll just highlight the things that I guess the Senate does not conform to. If you go down to page 5 where Ms. Manzi left off there, starting with the extension of the special rule for conservation property, you'll see that there are several items there which would require additions on the Minnesota return if we do not conform to them. And so I don't know if you want me to go through all of them individually or not, but they're listed probably down on page 5 and at the top of page 6 as well. So they would require additions on the Minnesota return. There are also, on page 6, we have major federal changes not conform to the required subtractions on the Minnesota return. And there are actually 3 of them. I believe the senators in their packet, there's a third one that's not listed there, requiring non-qualified deferred compensation of certain taxpayers, including taxable income. So there are 3 subtractions that would be required on the Minnesota return on the Senate version. And then the next section are major federal changes not conformed to that would require compliance with previous federal law. And those include, and I'll highlight a couple of those, the allowing like kind of exchange treatment for shares and mutual gift reservoir irrigation companies, the real estate investment trust treatment, changes to the Gulf Opportunity Zone losses. And I think the major provision there is the next section, which are many changes to depreciation for depreciation expensing, many business expenses there. And moving over to page 7, the top there of the Senate, the last issue there is changes providing more general expensing and depreciation for certain federally declared disaster areas. The next section is our major federal changes not conform to the require a recalculation of adjusted gross income for state tax, and you can see there are 3 provisions that would require that as well. The next piece there is the revenue offset for cost to conform the MMA. Ms. Manzi, you can talk about that first for the House.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the consequence of the House conforming to all the things that the Senate did not conform to is that the bill has a net cost in the first biennium, and that will pay for through delaying payment of corporate tax refunds from fiscal 9 to fiscal 10. The Department of Revenue has estimated for us that there will be adequate refunds to cover the shortfall in fiscal 9, and then the same thing happens again from fiscal 11 to fiscal 12. And since the revenue raisers in the federal bills tend to be more ongoing in nature than the cost items, in years after that, the bill is in balance. It wouldn't mean anything like that, even if we budgeted beyond the 4 years going forward.
Madam Chair, members, as you can see, for the revenue offset, we do not have a provision in that because our bill, the bill that is in our version, does not have any cost to the general fund, so therefore there's no revenue offset required.
The final section, titled Other, an amendment added on the floor in the House is a provision prohibiting the governor from appointing as commissioner of revenue an individual who's been convicted of a criminal violation of federal or state tax or revenue law, has failed to file an income tax return within a year of its due date, or has unpaid federal, state, or local taxes for the prior tax year at the time the appointment is announced.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate did not adopt that amendment.
Madam Chair, members, both the House and the Senate have a provision recommended by the Department of Revenue on withholding of differential pay for people who are called to active service. There have been federal changes to the definition of wages as far as withholding this goes, relating to these wage differentials, and the department has suggested a temporary change to how we administer this to sort of feather in to have the new federal rules on this.
Madam Chair, members, we have the same provision in our bills.
Thank you so much. Well, I just want to ask, sir, is your name Steve?
Yes.
Okay. No one mispronounced it. I didn't know how to say his name. So thank you, Mr. Steve. Thank you. Mandy, and I think, but looking at the clock here, because we want to break at about 4. So I think we just break on the lock from the attorney. This is here from the Department of Revenue, from this to noon. The House clerk has informed all these items, and so we kind of know why they're formed. But we would like the Department of Revenue to tell all the companies what are these groups of people that are not being conformed to, and what is the effect for all these different so we can just think about it rather than a detailed way here. Who are we talking about in all these provisions? And maybe this provision could walk through that, and we could have some discussion, and we could break and start green anchors after the break. So if we could get your federal conformity before the break, that would be just great.
So, any questions? Okay, welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I can just take a few minutes just talking about kind of the reality of non compliance with the Department of Revenue right now experiencing an impact here due to not complying with federal conformity updates at this point. As you know, this is an individual income tax, a federal graduate tax route, which is closely linked to the federal definition. The more we deviate from the definition, the more complex and burdensome compliance with our tax laws becomes. Because of the increased complexity due to non-compliance, it resulted in more mistakes and returns, increased number of returns being rejected, errors that have been experienced from the software vendors this past year, and also increased number of complaints. The Department of Revenue has been experiencing about 15 to 60 calls a day from taxpayers with federal conformity issues. Currently spending more like 20 a day. We expect to announce on that again to be able to find them more. We're also experiencing an increased number of returns being rejected, refiling due to the errors resulting in federal conformity. We're experiencing some issues working with SOC and our vendors because they've offices fairly complex when they're trying to adopt the non-conformity of federal law. So we are experiencing some upticks in those errors as well. I did want to mention that you asked regarding the examples for individual taxpayers. If you look through the whole list of federal conformity items, many of them have minimal or negligible dollars. There's a few items with a larger dollar amount, but the impact, though, of maybe a small dollar amount, the impact of individual taxpayers and businesses can be substantial, both in the time trying to comply with the law as well as the impact on their taxes on that matter. If I could give two examples of kind of the industry complexity, one relates to Richard's dealing with the IRA distribution for individuals who are 70 and a half and older who are allowed to do a distribution directly from their IRA to qualified charities. This provision impacts estimated roughly 2,000 taxpayers, and it was in for conformity for 2008-2009. We just recently received a letter of complaint from an individual who has done a directed distribution from their IRA of $660, so they're not necessarily doing a selfie taxpayers here. It really questions from the files that take advantage of this distribution. They did a year-end distribution directly to their church at $650, which is actually a tax-free distribution of the federal law. When they went to do their Minnesota calculation, it obviously then had tax consequences in Minnesota. The taxpayer was then required to recalculate the adjusted federal gross income for Minnesota tax purposes to add the specific distribution of the IRA to their income. What this means for some taxpayers, because of the adjustment of gross income, it may impact other tax provisions, such as Social Security. We might have resulted in more Social Security income being subject to tax. It can also impact some other deductions, such as the medical expense deduction, which is the income saved for. For this individual, he also, because he had a version of software that he was using, it did not allow him to utilize the minimum share deduction. It was a non-itemizer, so he could take advantage of the cap of that donation could have been deducted under the terms of the donation. Under Minnesota law. So working with the doctor, I need to get that information and software. So for that individual, it's not able to offset that charitable donation. So I just want to thank that we received for that provision. Another provision that I can highlight relates to a provision that was part of the first Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. In that bill, they have numerous provisions dealing with accelerated business expenses and depreciation. Really, the idea is trying to adjust our economy, I would say, at that point, to encourage business to take improvements, and also to provide some tough tax breaks during these tough economic times. One provision deals with allowing retail and restaurant businesses for certain property purchases or improvements to take a straight line depreciation over 15 years versus 39 years. What this would mean, for example, for a small restaurant owner, is they would need now to keep two separate legal conforming books. They would need to keep two separate set of books for that asset for over 39 years. And it's not just for that asset. What would happen is this small business would now need to recalculate their federal taxable income for Minnesota purposes, not just for this year, but for the life of the asset, but for 39 years, they want to recalculate their taxable income. Obviously, we have ongoing implications for this. I just want to finish with saying at this point in the tax season, we have about 1.4 million taxpayers on file and other returns process. So, about approximately 50% of the returns that we would expect based on last year's numbers, which is 2.6 million. Many of those impacted are federal conformity issues. However, probably would be more apt to hold off our filing because if you maybe hold out your tax return as well as to look online, that the past year we have more federal conformity, so we kind of raise some tax implications that there might be some action on federal conformity. So we estimate that those that are impacted on federal conformity issues are probably more apt to have held off and not filed yet. We still believe it's a benefit to taxpayers on federal conformity. Even though it's late in the filing season, it gives us some benefits and still provides a charity and reduces complexity for institutions that are taxpayers who are not filed. But also lessens the ratio of taxpayers who file and reduce the charity on the citizens. Any more questions? Myself and my students will also hear that.
Madam Chair, what's he doing? Do I remember in the governor's supplemental budget, did he do the Section 179 conformity in the supplemental?
He posted as well in his first budget announcement, and then after the federal passed their most recent federal conformity, he also modified.
So do you remember what that cost, the total?
On
the 179.
I've read up for the supplemental for the additional was around $3 million.
Ms. Cadoon, no, and this is an address on either side. But Ms. Cadoon, maybe Ms. Templin may be able to tell us. I can probably need to give her a minute, but I think what happened maybe while she's looking, in addition to the fact that the legislature, under both Republican and Democrats being the majority, has not conformed to Section 179. Obama has now taken that, ramped that up a little bit, so it's a little more expensive. Ms. Kadoon?
Yes, sir. And the governor's recommendation was for property taxes and services for 2009, and I think it was 2010,
so it wasn't impacted for 5 years. Ms. Kadoon, can you tell Senator Black's question? This last time we got to conformity on this was 2005. Is that right? And then 06, 07, 08, and now 09, you know, both parties have chosen not to do this, but I think the governor is now looking to do it, but not in either the House or Senate version of this bill that we have today, and then Obama's doing it as well. I don't know if someone can tell us definitively it was 2005, the last year Minnesota did it. Anybody know? We'll find out later. Mr. Michael says yes, and Ms. Manley says yes, but it's 2005. Chair Bob.
Madam Chair, I've always been a little reluctant to delay corporate tax refunds and do this informally, which was the House's approach. How would the governor feel about using some of the money that, as a result of the federal money coming in, now I think we have an unrestricted fund balance of about $236 million on June 30th. How would the governor feel about using, rather than delaying corporate tax refunds as the House proposes, actually using some of that unrestricted fund balance that we're putting out there? I think it'd be helpful if you find that out.
That's good. And maybe, I don't know, I saw the commissioner earlier this morning, and maybe you guys could sit here. Hi, Commissioner. were you quick calling the governor to ask him if he'd be okay with a little bit less of what he's got going so he can buy full confirmation? Did you catch any of that?
Madam Chair, I did
catch
some responses.
I don't think we have to know that today. I think it's unlikely we'll wrap this up tonight, but we've got a dinner day. You see, I don't skip meals, so I...
Senator Bob,
what are the rules of passing the gavel? I don't know.
I agree with her passing the gavel today.
We have rules on that?
I said that with that phone call yesterday.
I'm just kind of curious about that, because I think if we're going to do conformity, it just seems to me we have some money sitting on the bottom line in this biennium. Better spend this year's money maybe rather than next year's money. We have enough problems in 10 and 11 already without adding to it.
Mr. We could go as well as you. The sooner you can get that information, the better. I'll just speak to the Senate conference to let you know the Senate, the House has thought on this. You know, we went through this process trying to get to full conformity and heard, you know, the department's proposal here to do partial, and just basically thought it was a waste of time to do partial, where you're going through this process to get a bill signed. You're not permanently conforming to lots and lots of provisions. You're not passing on tons of tax relief until a May bill that may or may not get signed. So we had a number of meetings bipartisanly to try to think through how could we get the revenue raisers in the bill, throw the money from the future back into the current so that the governor could not be signing the tax increase. So really that was sort of the strategy here. Commissioner Reines and Assistant Commissioner Kadoon worked hard to secure that the governor could be okay with that, and we worked with the business community so that they could be okay with that because they're some of the beneficiaries of these provisions. And we had a lot of testimony. Maybe it would be helpful for Assistant Commissioner Kadoon to let the Senate conferees know what kind of delays we were looking at. It was very short term for not very many businesses. You know, we have a current that is 60A or 90A, and we've missed that a little. But so we thought we were coming up with a political solution to assist a lot of Minnesota taxpayers in a way that the governor can sign it. so we felt to go through the conformity partially, not even a deal with all these IRA contributors, not help the veterans who are trying to get their working family credit, not help, you know, all the places you guys have an empty box and we have a full box. We just didn't think it was worth it to kind of, you know, move everything through the house floor and then kind of get almost nothing. So that's where we were going. So if we could just take a minute to have this to talk about how the delay mechanism of the corporate refund would work. And we did take testimony from the business community on that and had conversations, and they felt comfortable with it. So, Ms. Kadoon, can you just explain that a little bit for Senate Conference?
Sure. Members, for the corporate delay,
is there any precedent? Has the legislature delayed corporate refunds before? Is it worth it?
Yeah,
sure.
We have delayed corporate refunds as far as I know. We did a similar tool when we delayed the capital equipment release, and that was back in the cycle 3
of the year. Okay. Sure, that wasn't a good idea either. That one, I remember, it was about $50 million. That's in my memory. Michael, do you ever remember delaying corporate tax refunds before?
Sure.
Delaying any refunds other than the capital equipment one that we did a couple years ago?
Sure, Senator Ball, I cannot remember any time you have held corporate or individual income tax refunds. I don't know if other states have done that, and in fact, they do it now, but we generally have been successful.
Senator Carrington, dreaming about this conference today and getting an opportunity to get together with you. I was thinking about the budget solution that Senator Cohen was dealing with, and maybe if we delayed everybody's request by about 2 years, we could solve this other problem. Victor, what do you think of that? Am I the only one that thought of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I think the solution that the House has come up with and the government has created as a funding instead of funding is a very surgical, short-term way of funding crisis. Now, granted, we may be sending some sort of ministry precedent, but I still think the value of doing that outweighs any kind of precedent we may be setting. I trust the community, I trust the vaccine market to meet this question. Funding priority that they think is a high value. I just think this is a very surgical way of the primary beneficiaries of the business community. We've had this become thoroughly comfortable with this. So it's knowing that all the refunds people, even ones that pull back and delay, we try to get those out of the first, last second, to be available. So we're really looking at a fairly limited tool in order to find something that's going to make the system a little better. So we think it's a reasonable change.
Now, Commissioner, My point is, why would we set some new precedent when we have $236 million now sitting unrestricted on the bottom line?
Well, I think, Commissioner, if you can get us that answer, that'll help us, because if you come back and say the governor can do that, I think that's another way. But I think it's worth trying to find an answer to that question. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, I'm going to address you later. Can you come back or ask the governor's office? That may be another way.
Further questions from any conferees on federal conformity? And I do want to add one piece for everyone to just think about, because we're going to go to the break here and then we're going to start with Green Acres. But I think it's easy to think, well, let's not conform to some of these things because we can raise the revenue later and spend it on something else. And I think that's not actually accurate. It is for big pieces, but that's not what this bill has got going here. So can either the commissioner or assistant commissioner talk about, you know, could you try to take just the revenue raisers that are actually kind of teeny and go spend them on something else? And as I recall, the original dollar amount on the expensive spread revenue estimates, which I see Ms. Padoon has in her hands, were in the hundreds of thousands to not do different things. So the delay of the refund is what allows the money that we need immediately, and then these revenue raisers actually raise a lot of money in the many years out. I think it's in mostly 2013 and 2014. So I think some legislators in both the House and Senate, both parties, may think that that's a revenue you can get this year and spend it on something in this biennium. And it's really not what it takes many years to collect the money, the revenue out into the future. So, Ms. Kadoon, can you comment on that?
This late in the tax filing season, I'm wondering if some of the provisions in here might score differently. My example, the $200 deduction for a teacher for classroom expenses, I think scores at about $1 million. Teachers bought those supplies last year, not expecting to get a tax deduction for that because it wasn't the law. So now if we adopt that provision, I think when that last time I looked at it, it scored at about $1 million in cost. I'm just wondering if we get this late in the tax filing season, for that $200 deduction, if the teacher's already filed, let's say they're in the middle tax bracket 7.05 or whatever we're at, 7.05. 7%, $200 is $14. I mean, is somebody really going to file an amended return and pay an accountant to do that to get $14? I mean, I just kind of wonder if, and so I kind of hate to spend $1 million, if it turns out fewer people are actually going to go through the trouble of filing amended return because it won't financially make any sense for them to do that. I just kind of wonder what other provisions in here, and that's one of the ones that actually is more expensive than some of the other ones. If the provisions in here, I mean, are people really going to file amended returns when we're this late, and some of the provisions score differently than they did 2 months ago?
Good. I don't know. I'd have to go back and have to research for some of the
I think that's kind of important. I mean, I don't think we should spend money on machines here that's not actually going to get spent. If there's a way to restore some of these, on the back of the napkin at least, I think that would be helpful. We all know what we're facing in this next biennium, and I think to the extent we have very accurate information on what this bill's going to cost, will help everybody over the next 2 months.
Mr. Chair, maybe the Commissioner wants to respond. I think that's a legitimate point on some of the obvious ones, like the ones you mentioned. I think the rougher ones and the tougher ones and the ones that really need to get this done immediately is these multi-year expenses that are really difficult for corporations and small businesses to keep to sets of books. And it's so complex that you can see why you haven't heard this outcry from the business community against the corporate delay in the refund, because you're looking at a 39-year problem. So I think you've mentioned one, and I don't think there are very many like that, where you could potentially reach for and find a savings there. So, Commissioner, can you think of others in here?
Madam Chair, Senator, the question is a good one. It's kind of asking to talk about, especially the education system. It is so late, and the more people are actually going to take the effort to talk about it, my recollection is, and Dr. Wilson, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that even when we passed the federal conformity district convention with the large omnibus bill, we have not rescored the federal conformity provision in the federal passed. I don't think it's been done before. It raises a question I asked as well.
Commissioner, are there others like that one that you can think of? I mean, maybe Ms. Mandy or Mr. Michael has a thought. I mean, I'm trying to think of any other provisions in here that fit like it. Ms. Kadoon, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the only one, the other one I can think of was the use of IRA distribution one that for some taxpayers is fairly small or almost like an individual. Maybe just an IRA distribution.
Ms. Mandy, can you add anything to this?
Madam Chair, we did make up a list earlier of the provisions that affect tax year 2008 returns, and many of them are business-related provisions. Generally, the businesses haven't filed their returns yet in anticipation of what the legislature is going to do, so they would be taking them. Or they're ones, like Ms. Kadoon mentioned, the IRA distribution, where I think if the person made a substantial distribution from their IRA that they were able to exclude from adjusted gross income, then it would very much be worth their while to go back and file an amended return and to recalculate all of the AGI-related items for state purposes. Other items for tax year 2008 had to do with farmers and ranchers who donated conservation property being able to take a larger deduction, and that would be even if it exceeded 50% of their adjusted gross income. So again, that would be deductions that would probably be substantial in size and would be worthwhile for people to go back and take with an amended return. There were a great many depreciation and expensing items which businesses would be tracking and would certainly go back and take the more advantageous basis that conforms to federal law. Let's see, there were deductions for business taxpayers of food inventory and book inventory. There was a relaxation of the 10% adjusted gross income limit on casualty loss deductions for residents of Cook, Fillmore, Cleveland, Houston, Power, and Noble counties.
Sandy, can you repeat that one again slower? And can we make sure the Senator Bach heard that one?
Is this something about the swimming pool?
No, that's swimming pool money. Okay. Sandy, can you repeat that one again?
Residents of certain counties in Minnesota, specifically Cook, Fillmore, Freeborn, Houston, Mauer, and Nobles counties, who suffered casualty losses in a disaster that occurred between May 20th and July 31st of 2008 that were not reimbursed, are able to deduct those losses without regard to the 10% adjusted gross income limit. So if someone had unreimbursed casualty losses, they would probably go back and file an amended return to deduct them.
Ms. Nancy, can I just interrupt and need a little bit more? Is that the Ham Lake Fire?
It's the Ham Lake Fire, Madam Chair, and nobody from Cook County has called or written me and asked for that deduction. Because they're probably not making any money, so the deduction probably doesn't do them any good.
Chair Bach, can I get your mailing address? I'd like to let
him
know.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Thank you.
This one I don't forget. Representative Dill really needs that swimming pool that he's
building. Oh,
is, I got another email out today from one of his constituents in Davis that was wondering how it was coming. They're all doing private fundraising to save the pool.
Oh.
And it's really important because. Continue his service in the legislature. So it would be nice if you could accommodate him on that. I just wanted to make sure I got that over on his behalf.
Did you see all the House
Conference
things
that
were coming
out? Have you heard of it?
No.
Well, look, you don't have a bias without even hearing the testimony on the bill.
We don't want to encourage them.
You're going to hear it.
From
them, my friend. We heard it in K-12 education finance, which I serve on. And I did have a few questions for Representative.
What are they doing over there?
It's a school matter.
It's a school related issue. Oh, I've seen it quite
clearly. Senator Bach, the tax committee hasn't asked to edit the tax yet.
Did they pass it over there?
No.
What did you do with it?
Leave it there.
Laid it over.
So they're incorporating their education matter.
Possible.
Does Representative Dillon know this?
I hope so.
I don't think he serves on education. It'd be a shame if it didn't happen. Representative
Dillon has argued long and hard for the school pool levy. Is that Speaker, former Speaker Anderson, who got that?
I was here when Speaker Anderson did the levy for International Falls, Little Fork. Anybody else? But I can't imagine. Who's school district?
It's just one pool, isn't it? They know
how many swimming pools
it is. Do you know?
It must be one of
those. Mr. Michael, how many swimming pools? Two swimming pools.
Their own
special
levy. The thing is, I think that's an important provision.
Okay.
Can we do it for ice rinks anywhere?
What?
Yep.
Okay, sorry, Ms. Mandy. Did you want to finish your list?
And if you, there's just a couple more items that are more generous limits for charitable contributions made for Midwestern disaster relief efforts. And then the final item was a revenue raiser that would be in effect for tax year 2008. So those people affected by that would not have a choice about filing an amended return. They would be required to file an amended return.
Further questions from any conferees on anything related to federal conformity? We think we've got the Senate completely convinced now that all of federal conformity needs to happen in the next day or two here. We want to take a second to have Representative Hosh introduce himself. He's our sixth conferee. Representative Hosh, where do you represent? We kind of went around and said that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Larry Hosh. I represent District 14B, which is pretty much the district smack dab in the middle of the state. Green acres is a large issue for us in Stearns County, and I think my district probably has the most individual parcels enrolled in Stearns County of any district in the state. So I appreciate the opportunity to be part of this committee.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, let's
reset. What other pinch hitter you've been bringing to conference? Green acres, is she still here?
She still yelled
louder
about Green Acres than she
did. Senator Sykes? Well, Madam Chair, speaking of Green Acres, didn't you have any bills introduced about Green Acres? I see it's all blank on the House.
We're going to get to that after the break. Senator Sykes, can I just say, take this minute before we recess to say that Senator Bach and Senator Skoy and senators will probably think I'm nuts when I tell them this, but I actually listened to all of the testimony and all the tapes of the Senate dealing with Green Acres and was in fact shocked to see what the A committee did to Senator Skoy's bill. Jeez Louise. I don't know. It is. But I also listened to Senator Skoy present his bill that is now in this bill. And Senator Skoy has been very thoughtful, and we appreciate that the issue is very complex, and people who want it to be simple, it isn't. It's very complex, and there are many moving parts, and those There's a lot of people on both parties here within Green Acres. It's just a black and white issue, and it isn't. And so I really appreciate the work of the Senate. We do want to get full conformity, and we have different ideas about Green Acres. But with, unless there are other questions, we're going to recess. We'll come back at 5, so if folks want to get something to eat, do it now. And Senator Bach's got a bill, and we'll come back, and we'll take up Green Acres. With that, we're in recess. Thank you. Next order. So I think we got everybody here, and if they're not in the room, they're close. So I think we'll just start and have Commissioner Ines report to us what he learned in the break. So Commissioner Ines.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I conferred with Commissioner Anderson, who showed up with the Department of Finance, and ran the Senator Bach's question by them essentially, and they are receptive to that. I think that's an acceptable way of going. They shared some of your same concerns, Senator Bach, about setting a precedent with the corporate refund proposal. So they're receptive to that as long as the revenue cost over 3 years, 09, 10, 11, is comparable to what the governor recommended in his initial budget. And I think we're very close as far as the House position and the governor's position in that respect. I think we're doing some quick math. If the House were to drop the 08 conformities for the education expense, I believe it would be, the numbers would be almost identical with the governor initially recommended in the initial budget. We're running another cost number, and I believe the Kavanaugh's deductibles but that was, they're willing to pay for it, and they might have to pay a but they don't want to
So, Madam Chair, Commissioner, if I offered up that the Senate might be willing to do 179, Section 179 conformity and spend an extra $20 million, Governor's not interested in that?
Yes, sir.
Did we talk about that being an extra $20 million? $22 million?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I didn't think that was before the conference committee, but if it was, the Governor would be willing to... That was going to be added to the federal conformity package. The governor will be more than willing to do so.
So he is willing to go above his number.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, the conference committee doesn't have 179 conformity before it, so we're going to play.
Okay, Assistant Commissioner, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I just want to make clear for Section 179, those provisions were in fact in the calendar year 2009 and 2010, so it's just for fiscal year 10, which is the level of cost and public as well. So it was not in fact for fiscal year 11, we have no recommendation.
But I think we should be clear, there is a provision in the bill on Section 179, so it's not as though it's not potentially something that Congress committee could discuss.
Yeah.
If you wanted to do that or something to maybe simulate any additional, how is the rescoring of our upfront exemption on capital equipment, Commissioner, do you think? Or is that already upfront exempt?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I think there's two different issues there as far as the 179 expenses and sales tax exemption for gas equipment. So I don't expect that those two results.
I just wondered if it would create me, if we adopted the 179, if it might create any additional purchases.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Bach, that was one of the reasons why we put in the bill, because I would provide additional incentive to boost investment, especially for small businesses where maybe understand what it's to invest in their business. One of the reasons why we put both those provisions in our tax bill was to try to incent some of that investment in small businesses.
But Commissioner, if there was additional purchases made because now the 179 expensing opportunity was there, would that change the scoring of the upfront exemption on capital equipment?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I think Dr. Wilson might be in a better position to comment on that. We had those two pieces in our bill, so we may get some interaction with Dr. Wilson.
Commissioner Senator Cohen would be taking in his boots if he was here right now.
Dr. Wilson.
I mean, someone thought the Senate wanted to do this after all this and the House didn't want it.
And Chair Bach, the House has already proposed doing it this year. In fact, Senator Heigl has already been heard, and but this proposal was not offered by the Senate, House, or the Governor in an early conformity bill. Being offered by the Governor in a May conformity bill. And we'll be happy to see if it's in your bill, but we've already heard House Bill 1872, and I've stated it.
Is that the governor's bill?
Nope. 1782. And that's given it. My hope is that we'll be starting on the tax bill, so we have the hope.
Do we know, Council, do we know if anybody's introduced the governor's tax bill?
Why did that show?
Been introduced.
Senator Bakken, I'm the author of the governor's tax bill in the House. I'm offering mine, as and everybody else's. So. Got anything you need here in the House? Got it up.
After how many Green Acres bills did you hear?
Well, we're going to get that. So if we can get finished with this, quick here, the spreadsheet, which we forgot, and then get to Green Acres, I think that's good. But this is good to have this information, Commissioner. We appreciate it, Dr. Wilson.
I'm sure that's good. When we do estimates for the upfront, for those upfront capital equipment or something of that sort, we're based on the February forecast, we have to be there. And we really don't have the kind of interactions you're talking about are the kind of interactions we just don't have capability to have. So we would not be investing in the forecast.
Senator Bach?
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Appreciate that you took care of that, Commissioner. Thank you, Dr. Wilson. And if Ms. Templin, Ms. Manzi, and Ms. Von Mosch can join us, we did forget to just quickly do the spreadsheet on federal conformity. And I think this is really helpful for all conferees, particularly Senate conferees, to see when we're talking about the money issue. I think one way to think about how does the House pay for it, this is just a timing issue. If we would have had money on the bottom of the line when the House was trying to do this, you know, we could have used it. Yeah, Senator Bach is not mentioning because there is money on the bottom line, but we were trying to do it right after unallotment. There's no money, and so we were trying to move these revenue chunks that are coming in later forward on the calendar. So it's strictly a timing issue, and I think if we quickly walk through the spreadsheet, which should be in everyone's packet, everyone will see how we were trying to just time the money to move the pieces around to make it work. So I don't know, Ms. Templin or Ms. Von Mosch or who wants to.
Madam Chair, Conference Committee members, I'm Cynthia Chan from House Fiscal Staff, and I think the approach we want to take is just to go over the summary sheet, and if there are questions on the detail, we can turn to the other pages. To start, I think we will also review just the fiscal 09 revenue impact, and then the 10 and 11 biennial impact, and 12 and 13 biennial impact. To begin, for the House, the insurance earnings assistance relief tax act of 2008. In fiscal 09, there's a revenue gain of $90,000. For the Heartland Habitat Harvest and Horticulture Act of 2008, there is a revenue loss of $370,000. And the tax, the Housing Assistance Tax Act of 2008, there is a $15,000 revenue loss. And finally, the fourth act, the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, there is an $18.5 million cost for the total federal conformity revenue impact of $15.7 million in fiscal 09. Moving down the corporate franchise tax refund, there is a delay of refunds from fiscal 09 to fiscal 10, and we see that revenue gain in fiscal 09 of $15.7 million. And moving down to the bottom line, the fiscal 09 cost for the health position is revenue neutral.
Yes, Ms. Senator Stein.
Just at this time, maybe I can ask, the $15 million that you're delaying, I understand it's kind of a rolling delay. And so how many weeks or days or months does it take to accumulate that $15 million before you start getting something back out?
Madam Chair, members of the Caucus Committee, I believe that the department can answer that in more detail, but I believe what I heard, those are the $15 million in revenue gain is from the delay of April, May, and June refunds.
and that they would delay the May 1st refund, and then first in, first, and then they would pay them back on the first in, first out basis.
So to start with, it would be about 90 days, and then it would gradually shorten up as time went along.
Templin's probably not wanting to answer for the department, is my guess. Our Commissioner Ines, does somebody want to? Okay. I think they're nodding, though. I mean, I think that's in general. I just.
The concept is about nice.
Yeah, you would, the estimate was the corporate refund should be $30 million effective to all April, May, and June. What we'd like to do is just hold it on May 1st to make sure that we hold back enough to $15 million, and we don't hold back to them to come up from the federal order in the process. The bill is going to be from all by July 1st. So if you want to hold them off all, we will move it from all on July 1st. But the whole point is that we can structure it in such a way that we do more on a regular first out basis. And so as we accumulate it enough, $15 million to make the target of this business from adding some of those that we hope on coming in. Because we've got to minimize the interest payments that have to be done, as well as minimizing the delay in corporate tax.
So in August, what would you anticipate the delay would be?
None. Anybody who is delayed would go out July 1st.
And then
the process is normal after that.
And then, Mr. Bloom, then there is the potential then that you'd have to do something comparable to that again the next year.
That's fine.
Then our understanding is to ensure that we're full enough on the following item. We would have them to hold in a much smaller amount of $7 million. So we would have to follow it for much period in June.
Thank you.
Senator Stoy, I think we're all phrased. Your question really helps. You can just jump ahead on the spreadsheet. The next biennium in the delay area, and you see that smaller number is the $7.1 million. So that's what Ms. Kadun was just stating. Senator Boehner.
Madam Chair, if part of the goal here was to get money out, like the stimulus packages, and we do have the $207 million or whatever it is, wouldn't it make sense at this point to get it out and not hold the corporate refund?
Senator Vandiver, I agree. I think you're right. We were trying to do it when there was no money. Now, as Senator Bach and Commissioner Ines were just talking about, if there could be agreement to use it. It's just a timing issue for all the money. So we probably could do that. But this bill was created when there wasn't anything available. So you can see there's two rounds of delay. There's the $15 million and the $7 million in the next biennium. And both of these numbers come from just trying to back into, even though there's $30 million of biennium available, the numbers were chosen to back into what you need to buy to get
right.
I
understand the flow. It just looks like, at least this year, we could just take care of it if we were going to do it.
Yes, Senator Vandiver, I agree, but we would have to do it for, both bienniums. We couldn't just
use it.
Right, it would not have to third. So I think it helps if
Madam Chair, if you spend money in nine, that actually raises money in the next bienniums.
Right.
One half.
Personally.
8.6 to the good.
Right.
And 11. Also better.
Right. Yep. And that was really the goal. We were trying to get the revenue down the road that people can see on the spreadsheet. We just didn't have any way to start the motion. So if we could get the online money, I think that works. So Ms. Monash and Ms. Templin want to just finish this, and I think we'll move to Grant.
Yeah, I'm
going to
go ahead and finish the House spreadsheet for by, and then Ms. Monash will go to the Senate. So looking at the biennium for fiscal 2011, the revenue impact of all four acts, as Senator Bach noted, is a revenue gain of $8.7 million in fiscal 2011. Moving down the spreadsheet, you can see that there is a delay of refunds. The cost for delaying the refunds in 2011 is $8.7 million. So there is the impact in the 2011 biennium is again revenue neutral. I also want to point out that in fiscal 10, that the project for an additional
$50,000 for initial interest on the lane to be funded. When you see that show up, it's a full 10 and then moving to the fiscal 12 and 13 the revenue impact of the four acts again raises $7.5 million. Most of that additional revenue comes from the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. And again, moving down the spreadsheet, you can see the revenue impact from the delay of corporate refunds is $7.6 million for a bottom line gain in fiscal 12 and 13 of a positive $390,000 in fiscal 12 and 13.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Looking at the Senate position on the spreadsheet, the Senate conforms to all provisions of the Heroes Act, which is the top line, at a cost of $90,000 in FY09, $140,000 in FY10 and 11, and $145,000 in FY12 and 13. And then skipping down to the Housing Assistance Tax Act, and the Senate conformed to two provisions within that act, and both of them are related to bond interest for tax-exempt housing bonds. And the negligible is actually on the wrong line because it's showing up under the Heartland, but it really is under Housing Assistance. So you can see that the bottom line for our federal conformity piece is the same as the numbers I just read, $90,000, $140,000, and $145,000. In Article 2 of our bill, we have the Green Acres provision, and we do have a separate revenue estimate for that. And like most of, well, like all of the revenue estimates that we've all been looking at for Green Acres this year, they've all been scored as unknown, because the number of acres that will be changing classification is can't be determined right now. So you see our bottom line net general fund impact is $90,000 in FY09, $140,000 in 10 and 11, and $145,000 in 12 and 13.
Thank you both so much. Is there anything else that one of you want to add before we jump to Green Acres, Ms. Temple?
Just really quickly, Madam Chair, that we will be updating this spreadsheet and posting it online.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Ms. Padoon and Commissioner Inez both, because this is, I think we all have some homework tonight to take for us to see what we can get done on how to pay for federal conformity. So that's helpful. Okay, so thank you. So I thought what would be best, and Dr. Senator Bach about this, I think we want to have someone on Senate staff tell us what the Senate provision is for Green Acres, and we want to have Ms. Baker and Ms. Mr. Hines from the House then go through the House's myriad of positions. There are myriad numbers of authors and hours of testimony, so we can get a sense of what the House is thinking.
Has the House passed any provisions so they have an official position on Green Acres?
We have a couple of times in the body of the whole have a position that repeal has not been successful. So a couple of times on full repeal and that has not succeeded. Beyond that, no. Nothing. But that doesn't mean that this group doesn't accurately reflect 134 members' views of what we ought to do. And that's why they're all here. Further comments?
Well, but they reflect the views. It's a good thing we have Senator Dibble on here to reflect the. So that somebody can reflect the views of the first class.
Well, Senator Bach. Senator Bach, you want to follow it. I am Green Acres in my district. And if you stand in the parking ramp of the Mall of America and throw a rock, you can land it on a Green Acres parcel.
Madam Chair? Senator Dibble does have three bills up in transportation.
So. Okay.
And I'm going to have two up later, so.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So, Ms. Bach, you want to help us through what the Senate view is on Green Acres?
Sure. Madam Chair, members, Article 2 of the Senate Judicial Road to House is the Green Acres proposal. Section 1 of the, and this begins on page 9 of your side by side.
Do you have a summary? No.
Section 1 has two provisions in it. This is the section dealing with the basic requirements for qualifying filmmakers. One is intended to essentially grandfather in structures that had been subject to green acres under the pre-2008 law, but after the enactment of the 2008 law would no longer qualify for green acres because they had less than 10 acres of the Class 2A property. So that would permit that kind of property to remain treated under green acres. There's a second provision in Section 1 that strikes the prohibition on including land of similar program or the prep programs or similar programs for being considered as part of the green acres project. So after this, those properties would be eligible for green acres to be rented. Section 2 is a series of amendments to the provision that was adopted last year dealing with the transition of the 2E property that would no longer be eligible for green acres treatment. And there's a number of changes here. The first is that we've struck the language that had essentially provided that the entire parcel would have been eliminated from green acres treatment if only enough part of it had been sold, transferred, or divided. So the effect of this change is just the part that is sold or otherwise transferred of that 2B land would be eliminated from the green acres treatment. But the 2B land under this proposal would be excluded from green acres and the one subject to green acres treatment after the 2013 assessment. So it would be the earlier of the transfer or the 2013 assessment for the 2B land. The language dealing with the 7-year recapture is stricken so that in all circumstances, if there's a recapture, it will come under the previous law, 3-year recapture provision. We also provide specifically that a transfer to a son or daughter of the owner won't disqualify the land from continuing in green acres treatment. And then provide to the property that has been set under the subdivision that's removed from green acres and moved into the new land conservation property tax program. This is a further in this proposal, would not have a recapture. Section 3 modifies the general recapture provision that was in effect before the 2008 law to provide a window so that any property that has been subject to green acres that's removed from the program between May 29th of 2008, which was when last year's bill was enacted, and before January 1 of 2010 is not subject to any recapture. Section 4 is the new land conservation property tax program. This program would apply to Class 2B property under two circumstances. Either it was Class 2B property that had been included in a green acre and had been subject to green acres treatment prior to the 2008 law changes, their cultural homestead is contiguous to 2A land and under the same ownership as the 2A land. So those are the categories of Class 2B property that would be eligible to be treated under this new program. The land has to consist of at least 10 acres, and the owner has to establish a conservation management plan for the land. There's some detail in the bill about the requirement that this plan would be prepared by an approved plan writer. Under the current draft, the Board of Water and Soil Resources would certify people who would be eligible to function as an approved plan writer. The land tax would have to be enrolled for at least 8 years under this covenant, and there would be at least a 3-year period, I believe, during which the first 3 years there could not be an application to remove the land from the toll map.
Sorry, Scott. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, this law, I think the first eligible time period is 4 years.
And you do have to give at least 4 years notice to get out of the program as well. The land would qualify if there were any delinquent property taxes on it at the time of the application. And it's also not eligible, property not eligible for enrollment if it is at the same time subject to 3 acres or the open space recreation law or the sustainable forest law. Or as well to being treated or assessed under a conservation provision. There's some detail on the application, maybe that's not important to go through right now, but the owner of the property has to apply by May 1st of the year prior to the tax payable year and would enter into a covenant that would be binding on the owner and the owner's successor or assigned, but that would run with the land. So even if the land is sold, that covenant would remain in effect until it could be terminated. When the covenant is terminated, and essentially during the time when the land is in this program, it's going to be subject to a reduced valuation so that the value of the property that's subject to covenant would not exceed the value that's described by the Commissioner of Revenue for Class 2A total property in that time. So, you know, any potential development value or value that's attributable to other factors would not be considered. And this would apply to the property, to the land, but would not apply to the house garage and surrounding
houses. Okay. Thanks, Clay. Sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Thompson. Members, I just wanted you to think about this valuation for a minute, because what the discussion point on these parcels are is that there is outside pressures driving up the value of anyway. And so what our thought was, we would remove those outside pressures off of this land, even though it's not ag land, it would be part of an ag homestead or something. Move the CI, the residential, the CEO rec, and go to the ag land. And that's the value that Ms. Ross was talking about. So if there's outside pressures, you remove those, and then the value would be the same as the land. I was trying to get that thinking about in your head, the reason for the value to be where it is in the market and what you want to reduce it to.
Thank you.
And Chairman, but similarly to the Green Acres program, special assessments that are levied after June 1st, 2009 would be deferred as similar to the way in which they are under the Green Acres program. When the covenant has been terminated, the land would be subject to a recapture of the previous 3 years worth of the difference in the property taxes based on the value under this program versus what it would have been as the ordinary market value. Section 1A is a provision not related directly to the Green Acres law so much as it reduces the classification of agricultural land. Under current law, provided that Class 2A property may contain property that would otherwise be classified as 2B, specifically including schools, wooded wind shelters, acreage abutting ditches, and similar land, if it's impractical for the assessor to value that separately from the rest of the property. The amendment in this section would require the assessor to include this property rather than have that be optional, to include that otherwise Class 2B type of property in Class 2A, add the specific types of properties that would be subject to this ravines and rock piles, and it also has the qualification that the property would be included if it's unlikely to be able to be sold separately from the rest of the property. That's in addition to it being unlikely to be or impractical to the assessor to value separately. Section 6 requires the Commissioner of Revenue to study and annually report to the shares and on taxes. Regarding trends in market values of Class 2A and 2B properties, CMAQ's value methodology determination and assessment and classification practices to produce classes 2A and 2B properties.
Thank you very much, Michelle. And I think what I'd like to do is just kind of turn this over to Representative Marquardt to kind of, you know, I don't know what all Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines, but Representative Marquardt,
thank you very much, Madam Chair. And that's correct. The House does not have an official position. We have to clearly fall back on current law. But even though we think there's been 18 bills that have been introduced, I think we heard 17 on March 17th. So we've had plenty of discussion, but before I'm saying any more, if Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines is over, we've got a matrix of all of the areas that we're going to go. If you could quickly run through those, that would be great. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, also, Representative Junkie heard a couple days worth of hearings at least and produced some bills out of the Ag Committee.
We lovingly call this the matrix, okay? So that's what y'all want to see here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm going to start by covering the first page of the main this handout and quickly, just to give a sense of the sort of consensus of the House, perhaps by just the features of the bills that were introduced. And what we tried to do was extract from them the common elements and isolate the differences to the extent we could. And the first five columns or so deal with rural vacant land that is no longer eligible for green acres under the 2008 changes. And the first line of the matrix is current law, just to refresh everyone's memory on what is in current law and these various features. And then any place there's a blank in the matrix indicates that that bill does not propose to change that aspect of current law. The first column is the feature to allow you to withdraw part of your land without withdrawing all of it, and that was virtually unanimous. All the bills had that provision in the provision stated. The next feature had to do with whether this rural vacant land could remain in the program if it was transferred. And most of the bills provided for this, sometimes they limited it to some relatives, and they were a little different definitions of the relatives. Some did not restrict it to certain relatives, or maybe just transferred to anyone. So it's more a grandfathering of the land versus the land ownership, I guess, is the way they come to talk about it. The third one, the column that was drew a lot of interest, was the deadline to withdraw at the reduced rate. This was the rate that this was the one-year provision that was put in law on the January 2nd, 2009 date that everybody, I think, is familiar with that caused so many problems. And basically, almost all the bills proposed extending that out 1 year in 2010. And sometimes it's best by January 1st and sometimes May 1st, but I think that was more of a mistake than I ended up drafting them, that it really probably could have been May 1st, maybe a preferable date on that. The next column has to do with the back tax payment for a property that was withdrawn before that deadline. This was the 3 years under current law, under the law that we passed, which was the 3 year versus seven. And as you can see, some of the proposals did not change that. Many of them eliminated that, so that there was no back tax, which is just within the 1 year deadline or the 2 years, depending on what measure from now. And then finally, then the other one is the back tax. If you didn't withdraw it early deadline, so if you left it in, and that was the provision that was changed to 7 years, many of these bills shorten that back to the 3 years that had been in existence before. A few did not change it. For example, the acceptance bill actually changed it to 5 years. And then the next set of columns deal with sort of not particularly related to the grandfathered land. The first one there was an explicit prohibition against sheep crop and rim lands to be included in being acres placed in last year's law, and most of the bills, many of the House bills, would eliminate that prohibition and sort of reauthorize that kind of property to be 3 acres. Then these next two columns are where there's not as much uniformity. A number of the bills did broaden the definition of Class 2A and moves up. Described that the Senate bill did some of that as well, given that the rulers Jim Shelton is carrying that perhaps somewhat further. Some of the bills then in the next column allow some rural vacant land to qualify for the rulers, where some of the bills did actually explicitly say that some rural vacant land could begin being acres in the future. And the next page is where there's sort of the next two pages of this handout kind of get into more detail on some of these issues that we've got through columns. And then the final column on that first page is a number of the bills did create conservation programs for certain kinds of land, not some similar to the one in the center provision. But I should add that the last bill listed on the list before the repeal bill is House Bill 1663. Is really the Senate bill as we was introduced by Representative Jackson. I think Karen could introduce those two pages too.
Excuse me, just a minute. Did you hit that there on the Senate side? So, which is the Jackson bill? 1663 is the same as your bill, Senator Cook. And we intentionally got it and tried to draft it so we could get it in and get it heard so we could. So that, so you can see where the Senate bill lines up in the matrix. So it's on there. So think of 1663 as the Senate position. Okay? That's an accurate portrayal? Okay. Thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cook, going on to the next if you just look at the second page, like Mr. Hanks just stated, the second and third pages are really just backup for some of these items to explain them a little bit more. And very quickly, you can see on the broadening the definition of Class 2A that there were 4 bills there that actually expanded that definition. And what we did is like the first one for Faust, that's actually current law where we're showing what was actually struck in current law and then what we added here, or what was added. And the Faust bill and the Jackson bill on the 1663, they're quite similar in that both of them are getting at, in the Faust bill, it talks about the interspersed with productive agricultural land such that it was impractical for the property to be sold separately. And that was the language that came out of the Ag Committee when Representative Junkie, when they were working on the bill. The bottom on allowing some of the rural vacant land to qualify, you can also see that there was a few different ideas here on with the Faust bill that was the only bill that actually went just for the agricultural homestead to be enrolled in Green Acres. And it also was limited to a number of acres equal to 2A, so you couldn't have more 2B land than you had 2A land. But it grandfathered in the current property from a standpoint of homestead, so it wasn't, or for non-homestead, I'm sorry. So it wasn't like it took any of the ag non-homestead out. And then the Jackson, she had a House File 634 where she actually has prairie, wetland, wasteland, or woodland that's contiguous to real property that's devoted to ag purposes. So she was coming up with a different kind of definition of what should be considered rural vacant land and included in to be able to be included in Green Acres. Then if you turn to the last page, these were the conservation programs that were in some of the bills, and the House File 99 Adkins, that is, I think, the companion for what you put in the Senate language. Yes. House File 338, Representative Kalin's bill, that was a different program in that one counties actually designated
preservation and legacy areas, and it had language about giving consideration to creation and preservation of water buffers, wildlife corridors. And in this one, like I said, it was a county option, and people had to, that were, if you were in that particular area that the county set that the county deemed important, then owners actually had to apply for that to participate in the program, and it also included Crep and Rim. That was automatically eligible, and that required a covenant. And in that case, property was assessed at 25% or 0.25, so it got a property tax rate with that particular program. House File 634, that was that provision. She had also the Halen conservation land, but in addition to that, she had, if you remember the Otremba language that was in the House bill last year, for land that was not being farmed and abutting public waters and contiguous to ag land. She also had that particular provision was put in her bill. And then the House File 1663 is the Senate bill.
Senator Horton.
Thank you very much. You know, there's been a lot of input on a lot of these bills, and like I said back in March 17th, a week ago, 8 days ago, we heard 17 bills in a three-hour meeting and heard lots of testimony and so forth. And kind of from all of the input, you know, from what come out of Representative Judge's committee and these meetings and looking at all those 17 bills, Representative Junkie and Representative Conan, Representative Virginius, Representative Hansen, Madam Chair and myself, we've been kind of working on things, trying to piece some things together that kind of takes all of this together and kind of compiling that. So, Ms. Baker, if you would, Representative Hansen and Representative Junkie introduced the conservation piece just recently. Could you go over the main points of that, if you would, please?
Passed out.
If you just hold on to this for a second. And Madam Chair, I also have to say, you held a meeting last Thursday, inviting all legislators, Democrats and Republicans alike, and so this is input from that too, from the
community. Maybe when we get through this, you know, maybe Representative Johnson and others want to chime in on kind of what where the House is going here. Ms. Baker.
The House File 2113, you have the language, but Steve and I put together just kind of the main points that are in 2113, and it is called Preservation of Riparian Buffers. And what this bill does is it gives a property tax benefit to all that property that is within the 50 to 100 feet of the ordinary high water level from all lakes, streams, rivers, everything, but there are covenants that are attached to it. The definition of riparian buffer is contained in the bill. It's a strip of area of within deep-rooted native prairie vegetation, including trees, adjacent to all public waters, and it extends the minimum of at least 50, but maximum 100 feet. Public waters is a very broad definition for all rivers, lakes, streams, but it does exclude wetlands. What it provides that land that constitutes this riparian buffer gets a preferential property tax treatment if there's two different options here. One is if an owner agrees to an irrevocable covenant to maintain the buffer and not to develop the or farm the buffer, the land is valued at 25% of the average value per acre of land classified as rural vacant land in the township. what this does not set up a new classification system. What it's really doing is telling the assessor that this strip of land, instead of valuing it as whatever the average value per acre of land, the rural vacant land, would be, it's taking 25% of that, and so it's giving really a 75% reduction in this particular, because here it's an irrevocable covenant. So the farmer or the landowner has really agreed that they will not do anything with this land, and they will keep it in its natural state. If the owner agrees to a revocable covenant to maintain the buffer and not to farm the land for at least 20 years, and that's what the length of the covenant minimum has to be, then there's a reduction in value, so that it'll be valued at 75% of the average value. And of course, in both of these, you're really starting out at the ag value. So, you know, what this does is, in both of these, it gives the benefit of what the highest and best use would have been. So it's really the 25 and the 75 are measured against that. The landowner has to agree to maintain the buffer, and there's language about maintaining it. And the landowner has to file an affidavit every 3 years with the assessor just stating that the buffer is being maintained. And if they don't abide by it, there's language in that they do get like a notice saying, you know, you're not maintaining it. And I think it would be DNR and some of those officials that would see that kind of thing, because I'm not sure that the assessor would be the one that would. But that way, if they're not maintaining the buffer properly, then the tax benefits that were accruing since the property was enrolled would be due and payable and would be pulled out of the program. So.
Well, let me just a little clear on what's going on. So this would apply to every acre of land next to any creek, lake, or river within the state?
It would, if in fact the people or the landowners decided that they wanted to take, put a covenant on it. And a 50 to 100 foot. I mean, so it's 50 foot minimum, 100 foot maximum. But the taxpayer does have to agree to a covenant for 20 years or an irrevocable covenant permanently. So this is a conservation program that is protecting the water.
But now, Chair, if we were to take a 50 foot buffer along all the lakes and plant this grass, and then they just build their house right off the edge of that. I mean, this is the most valuable land in the state. And we're going to give this land that abuts all our lakes and creeks and rivers and streams this tax break for doing what they legally probably can't do anyway, because it's already classified as some kind of wetland.
I think that if you read how you've got it, what you got to do it, it's pretty stringent, and I would guess lots of people aren't going to want to do that. I mean, that's voluntary. Ms. Baker, you thought that that's better choice.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, this can't be residential land. I mean, this has to be rural acre land that you are doing this to. So I'm not sure that, you know, when you're talking about if you're putting a house on the other side of it, we're not talking about rural vacant land. No, this is not a blue water stuff. Not at all.
Know what blue waters is, and it's not this, and I think that you didn't sell insurance because I hear what you're saying, but that's not it.
Well, sure. Is the covenant just on the 50 or the 100 feet, or is it on a parcel limit?
Ms. Baker or Representative Junkie?
Well, Madam Chair, and Representative Scoy, again, maybe we could back up just a brief bit on the conservation piece. Frankly, when we heard bills in our committee, we made the decision in agriculture, this is an agriculture program, that conservation would be a separate bill. You know, whether it's Mexican or Atkins or whether it was a Keeneland and whoever had that in the Senate, Olstein or whoever, we said, you know, if you want a conservation program, great.
go down to the Environmental Committee and set it up, and go down to taxes and set it up, and we'll talk about it. Now, I know you put it in there probably to garner some votes, maybe. I'm not going to, you know, speculate why it's in there. So one decision I think that we have to make is, do we include a conservation program? And if that's a good thing and we're going to include it, then we ask folks in the House, say, well, what, in addition to what you had suggested, what would also you want included? And so, frankly, Representative Genius and Hanson mainly sat down and looked and said, one of our, and Hanson's been on the ditch buffer people, and this isn't on county ditches, it's on rivers and lakes and things, but it's a similar concept, obviously. And so we got to protect our wetlands from runoff in an ag area. So clearly that's a public benefit that they're looking to put in here. And then in deference to, if you know, Representative Coy and other folks from rural areas, there's always a debate on whether easements should be permanent or temporary. And so we gave two options to a person in here that can put it in more of a permanent easement forever and get a better tax break for it, or, you know, someday we might want to use that land or farm that land or, you know, whatever the needs might be in the future we can't see. And that's why you see the temporary easement, albeit 20 years, but that's temporary in farm speak when you talk about CREP or some of the easements we've done in the past. And so that's what I support. So I think, you know, really what this is saying is, if we're going to put a conservation piece in, let's consider this as a position, either in addition to or with this, yours and something else, but let's add to it and not subtract from it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Junkie, the conservation part of this bill is added in there because there was a significant number of acres that were enrolled in Green Acres that just wasn't able. If you read the legislative auditor's report, I think it was 40% or 38% or some huge number like that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at the Green Acres bill and we listen to all the issues that residents across the state and other legislators were bringing forward, we were looking at the traditional ag bill. Well, that got covered pretty well in the Green Acres law. Now, there was all these parcels that would be non-conforming for the Green Acres, and what happened last year is they got grandfathered in. Well, grandfathers don't work very well for tax policy people because you end up with two parcels getting different treatment depending upon the basis they enrolled in the program. So we tried to get away from the grandfather. That's what brought us to the conservation program. So when you take the acres that are across the state that were enrolled in Green Acres, 60% of them were A-land. So they just go into Green Acres. No problem. Then there's the 40% that's kind of left. What are we going to do with them? Well, I mean, we could have called this conservation program, you know, rural vacant land or who knows what. I looked at what Senator Metzen was working and tracked along closely with him because our two bills moved together in the Senate for the Tax Committee. And then we thought, well, we will get rid of the grandfather, have a place to put these parcels of land that people across the state are saying add value to their communities and give them some preferential tax treatment based on the policies of Green Acres, which was that there are pressures outside of agriculture driving up the land value. So that's where the conservation land comes from. It's an effort to deal with the values on these farms that are adding to their community. We're going to give them some preferential tax treatment. This is a pretty major expansion of what the Green Acres law was. I mean, this is quite a bit step beyond that. Whereas the parcels that are in our bill are all ag homestead or else have been in the Green Acres program earlier, not green land abutting, you know, all the rivers and creeks. And if you ever look at a map of Minnesota, if you include all these parcels of land, it's a lot. I mean, it is a lot. And a lot of that is going to be seasonal rent. It's going to be land that you kind of wonder if you should be giving a preferential tax treatment or not.
So I think that'd be a different classification, though. We're not
well,
classified seasonal rent.
Well,
it'll be our relation.
Yes, you got to be in rural Nathan.
It's only the rural plan.
To represent Junkie, you want to further on that?
Well, no, and fundamentally, I agree with what Senator Sloy is saying. I mean, this is still on the rural bank and Green Acres part. It's not on everything. And number two, you know, we... Frankly, we did in our committees, we listed all these bills, then we did the Lean Everything Amendment and sent the post bill out with one of these post bills, the second one, I believe, and that was kind of our position as we came out of Ag Committee. And the way we handled it, your question, your problem, the way we handled it was you could enroll up to 50% of the tillable, which would be the non, you know, so if you had a 10-acre wooded parcel on a lake, and you had 50 acres of ag land, you could enroll it, be part of that farm unit. So we handled it a different way, but fundamentally, it's exactly what you just described, is to allow those plants to be in. We're not differing on that. But this is just still on the ag land, Green Acres ag land, you know, the rural bacon and the ag classifications, only, not on everything.
Okay, yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Duffy. So how would this interact with the proposed conservation program?
I'd have to look at that. Cool, sir. I mean, I'm just looking at your conservation plan.
Senator Sloy, I know Senator Vandegrift. I think health countries are, you know, more divided on things like you all are. So, but I think we were thinking that, you know, most of these bills had either green PRP and green path or both. And I think we thought one should come back into Green Acres, right, and one should not.
That's true.
And, you know, there are companies that can tell you the nuance of how they thought that, and that was with a lot of work from the folks who tracked conservation, too, so I don't know if Representative Junkie can recall.
Well, sure. Clearly, the CRP we would include in the House thinking, because clearly that would ag land. There's no question. REM was a choice you made, and you're already getting enhanced benefits for going into REM. So you shouldn't need a second enhancement to go into it. You've made that decision on REM. REM is typically a 100-year easement plus. And so you've already made that, and you're already getting preferential treatment for that REM land, where CRP, you know, really is ag land, and probably could come out someday and whatever. So we did make a distinction because of the benefits already allowed under REM and those types of programs. And so we thought CRP certainly made sense, or CREP, or any of those programs that were able to.
Yes, Representative Junkie, here's a real point thing. Does the REM land have the same conditions for enrollment that it had to have some productive agriculture on it?
And Madam Chair, no, not in total, and in fact, but again, REM is almost is the same as Green Acres, but it's a longer program, and you know, you can't do anything with REMland other than shoot pheasants off it or whatever. I mean, that's, you're not allowed to develop, you're not allowed it for a much longer period of time. So someone's already decided to go in there. We don't have to give them another benefit. They're already getting that benefit with the REM, and they've made that decision.
Madam Chair, my comments related to the Representative Junkie's environmental component, it sounds like that's off to the side, so at this juncture, I'd
Thank you. Representative Demmer, what are you thinking? Jump in here. Come on. Yeah, use the mic. I mean, because we really, you know, we want to get this done. I think it's a great deal to get resolution here tomorrow, so we got to get everyone on the record what they're really thinking here in a public way. So, Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think as far as I'm concerned, on the ag land, we're not one of those parts. You look at what the Senate has done, you look at the bills that have been introduced in the House, I think we're of the same mind. I think we may need to clean up a couple of things or whatever, but the big thing is the conservation one, and I guess my thoughts, we have not had, I know in the Representative Junkie's committee they've had some discussion about this. This bill, 2113, I think it is brand new, Madam Chair, in numbers. And I guess, be honest about it, in my opinion, the conservation part probably should be there. There's members and people calling for that. But we have not talked about this much in the House. And I would like to see that brought before committees. And quite frankly, Madam Chair, it should go to your committee, or at least to the Marquardt's committee, but it's a tax issue. And for us to look at doing this as a conference committee, enacting that, without having the hearings or anything in the House, I think, well,
if
I'm supporting the concept, I'm not sure the process is
right yet. Madam Chair, I'm just curious. I don't remember how the House operates, but.
Well, you
Morehouse train.
In the Senate, the tax committee is going to be the last stop for a bill, where it goes to the floor. Bills go through and then they stop. The final stop is either finance or taxes and go to the floor. I'm just curious if the House is different. I noticed this bill got introduced, and it clearly should, I would think, have been seen by a number of committees, but for some reason it was referred directly to taxes. And what the thought process was there.
Senator Bach, I think it got referred directly to taxes because you guys decided to not do all of them harmony and put Green Acres in this bill, so we're trying to get ready to kind of get the House's view here. I mean, had we not had a conference committee on federal conformity, we'd be looking to insert our ultimate solution from the Ag Committee, the Environment Committee, and Tax Committee into Representative Markworth's division report that would become part of the omnibus tax bill. So we're trying to figure this all out on the fly here, and I want to, you know, I agree with Representative Demmer that not everything's perfectly fleshed out. On the other hand, we're constantly hearing the, you know, everybody's ready to till, everyone's cutting down trees, we got to hurry, so we're trying to resolve as much as we can.
What Senator Scoy was trying to accomplish, he was trying to find a home outside of the idea of grandfather for those acres that was enrolled in Green Acres that really, most of us agreed, didn't belong there. The legislative auditor agreed they didn't belong there. So we were just trying to find another place outside of the grandfather to put them. This bill, 2113, is much more than I think the narrow approach the Senate was trying to take is relative to those Green Acres, those parcels that have previously qualified for Green Acres.
I think that may be, we hope you'll be open to it though, because if we can't get this all resolved in this conference committee, we're just going to deal with it all again. So, I mean, we're trying to get everything in front of it, you know, folks who are all here. Senator Olstein, have thoughts?
I'm sure. I have spoken to so many groups and angry groups on the Green Acres issue that I think a lot of the things, you know, the big five were, you know, the 3-year payback, pass it on to your heirs, crept rim, you know, those kinds of lands being included. And then Senator Scoy early on had talked about, you know, a period where there, if you took your non-productive Green Acres land out, there'd be no payback. And then, so those, a lot of the, all the things that were, I was hearing in different groups that I was talking to about this bill and the thousands, it seems like, emails that I got, I think everything is addressed in probably from this bar over on your stuff. But when Senator Scoy came up with this conservation covenant, you know, I was surprised by that, but the more I hear about it and I've talked to people that it sounds like a real nice solution to what do we do with lands that aren't really farmland, but we want to do something to preserve them. And so this seems to me to work out, it gives an option for people to enter into that program, and we can preserve those lands for many years to come. So I'm pretty pleased where the bill is right now.
Thank you, Representative Cole. What are you thinking? Didn't everybody
stop
out here on the record, so we can all...
Madam Speaker, I think, too, on the ag land stuff, we can get there without too much problem. We'll get it agreement here. On this conservation stuff, I think in the House we would have liked to spend more time on it, but you're attaching Green Acres to the conformity bill, kind of run the clock out on it, so we had to move faster than we otherwise would have on that. But with the testimony we heard, there was no question that many of them felt that these lands that weren't necessarily tillable were so important to the farm for diversity and water quality and all that thing, all those types of things. And I think this bill, 2113, took that pretty serious. He said, if in fact that's that important, we need to do something, you know, that's pretty pretty substantial. I think that bill does that. But, and I understand that it goes farther than what you guys are looking at in the Senate. To be honest with you, I haven't spent a lot of time with this bill myself, except to understand the basics of why they think it's important for water quality and such things. But as we go through this, I would hope that you on the Senate side would look at this and give it some consideration.
As I'm sort of calling people out here, I hope people will feel free to just comment about anything, not just conservation, anything on the major. I don't know what people are thinking here. Senator Scoy, then Vandermeer, and then I'm going to ask Representative Hosh to comment. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who to address the question to, but let's just use a real-world solution. I'll use our farm. On our farm, we've got the Clearwater River and the Rocky Brook that flow through us. We've probably got just a mile and a half. And most of it would meet this definition. And so I can take that land and I can go down to the county assessor and sign up all those acres and take 25% of what I'm currently paying on those parcels.
Forever.
And this land is grass strips. Legally, according to the state wetland law, you can't do anything with it anyway. So I could get 25, well, I could sign in 20 years.
Then you could 75. So we're just going to...
Does that make sense, that you would give me that kind of tax break?
I guess, I think what we were thinking as we were going through this with, the conservation folks in the house, if people are going to get a tax benefit for conservation, we want to make sure they're actually doing conservation. And evidence and whether they're revocable or irrevocable make people actually do it. And so I don't know that people would be willing to do it. And if they're not willing to do it, then they're not going to get a tax benefit. So I think we were thinking more along that line. To that point, before Senator Vandermeer or some remark, get a final.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. There's more to that than just setting it aside. It's that in order to qualify, you also must maintain the buffer. I mean, there's a little bit more than that, and there's a number of things here that you'd have to go one step. So that's just setting it aside. It's inspecting it periodically, preventing, addressing any snow compaction from vehicles, control weeds and management.
Well,
I'm sure.
If you guys think about what that land is like, it's grassland. It's been grassland for probably 200 years. I don't know whatever it is. It's just outside of our field. We left it there to protect the Rocky Brook that flows through our farm. We're never going to do anything with it. We legally can't. But now we're paying, we're paying taxes on it because it's part of our farm. Now the river, the wooded river land that I read this, you got to have trees and all that. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to walk out there and say, yeah, the trees are still there? I mean, it's pretty odd that we would give preferential tax treatment to landowners. They're doing something by law, they're restricted from developing either. It seems a little odd here.
The testimony we bring on the floor and in the committees is folks that reacted to the 2008 changes want to have all this land that this conservation, they acknowledge they're not doing agricultural production on. They want to keep a tax benefit, and we're trying to get a read on where the whole house can be in the end on the Senator Vandermeer?
Well, Madam Chair, if we're back on 2113, I don't think that, I can't see how it fits with what Senator Scoy's bill is trying to do as far as, this just deals with riparian buffer, but I don't see how it meshes with the rest of the bill. First of all, and secondly, I think you would be talking about a lot of money here deferred. Then we'd have to talk about process for getting that money back if you're determining. So you can't just have a DNR guy go out and say you're in default and you owe $4,000 or $20,000 or whatever. So I think we'd have to want to see more in that respect. But I don't see how it physically ties in with the non-productive. It's just dealing, it looks like, unless I'm reading it incorrectly, it's just dealing with precarity.
Well, I think, Senator Vandermeer, I think we're talking about the non-productive lands, right? And that's what this is all about, is the folks who've had non-productive lands in Green Acres who got taken out, and now they want it back in. So I think the House is trying to say that there's some ability to put their lands back in. We want to have them show they're actually going to do conservation.
Well, I'm sure. I'm sure.
since, what would we have, 35 counties that were never enrolled in Green Acres? And now we're going to give them all an opportunity, those 35 counties that were never enrolled in Green Acres to start with. Landowners are going to get some opportunity to enroll their land in this program. And what we were trying to address was the grandfathered land in Green Acres, and now this bill proposes to open it up to the 35 counties that never even participated in Green Acres, because it applies to all agriculture. I don't know how many days you want to spend on this, but it's just a real stretch to think that we're now going to include the 35 acres that were never even, all the ag land was never even intentionally by the counties, not, the program was never in those counties.
Madam Chair, much of the discussion is dealing around rural vacant land, of course, and we also worked on some things with kind of the traditional Green Acres, and I asked Karen Baker and Sue Hines to put together a bullet point of taking all of the bills together. It might help bring some of this together on how we deal with grandfathering and rural vacant land and so forth. So it's not the conservation part, but it's the group that's been working and looking at all the bills on kind of what we consider the normal Green Acres program. So if we could
I think that's helpful. Representative Dammer has a question, though, and I wanted to give Representative Posh's thoughts here. We get every conferee to weigh in on something before we do the next step. Representative Dammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my question is for Senator Skoy. I assume this is your language show. Is it your intent that the rural vacant land, the new law, let's just say current law, rural vacant land and the current law, would be allowed with the changes that we have in the to take the park that's not the conservation park, the 7-year lemonade and your native parties and all that. Is it your intent that the rural vacant land that's been grandfathered in be there but have a place to go after it's grandfathered? In other words, if I've got rural vacant land that's grandfathered in, you can have to set a language, and then your intent is to give me some place to go with that sometime between now and 2013. And in 2013, I have to decide. Is that your intent? And if I can add to that, if I don't have land in, again, in the first place, if I have rural vacant land that's not in Green Acres, in your conservation plan, I would have to go with that now, too. Is that correct?
Sorry.
Am I right in terms of the spirit?
Okay, Representative Johnson and Representative.
I just want to tell everyone, don't let's not get hung up on the conservation piece.
Yeah.
I think we all are. We're just trying to figure out what to do with those 10 or 5 or 7 acre pieces that were adjoining this land that really could be separated probably because they're on a lake or whatever, and I have a number of those in my district. To the 50 or 100, just one of the biggest problems we have with all of this, and I think we'll all admit it, and frankly, I don't know if Anastasia is here, but they'll admit it too. A lot of this is the assessor's problem. I do real estate appraisal, I do farm appraisal, I do it all over the state, and when I go into every county, it's different. And some assessors will assess wet, waste, and road, what you're just talking about, as not able to farm, for $50 or $100 an acre, and that's it on their assessment. Others will, like you say, put it all into some tillable class, like 1, 2, 3. I mean, it's nuts. And so a lot of this problem is because of assessors, and if we can give some direction to them to get more uniform on what they're doing, Representative Stoy, and I know you've got that in yours, that will help. Otherwise, your language versus what we're thinking, I think, is close. You know, if we can come to agreement on the RIM CRP part, if we can come to agreement on the years to be in that conservation, some people think 8 is too little. Maybe you think 20 is too much, but I think we can, if you're serious about conserving this, I think we're close on a lot of this, and we can kind of blend them, and let's just not get hung up on this, because what we're trying to do is keep that entire parcel, rural vacant and agriculture, as one unit, homestead, contiguous land, and I think we're very close. So I don't want us to get hung up on arguing this conservation too much, but I think the ultimate goal is the same, and I think at the end we're going to get what we all were thinking about.
I think that's really helpful, because I think that's a piece and we've got a bigger chunk to deal with, and we want to just show, we want to show the Senate another idea the House is working on here and get reaction, but first, yes, please, Senator, quiet, please.
I think if you look at this matrix down to the one that is my deal, you'll see that the vast majority of the tranches above that line are comparable to the tranches above that line. With regard to the assessor question, I think you're absolutely right. That's why we took some of the discretion away from the assessors in this current program, and that's why we asked the department to do their review of these programs.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the proposal in front of us, I think 2113, I think it's a good intention, a good direction to go. I can just show you about 20 pictures that a constituent emailed me literally an hour ago that this would probably be very helpful for their neighbors. However, I mean, I feel that it might be a little premature on where we're going with this. I'd like to know what some of the consequences are to the colonies and other local government jurisdictions that I don't think I feel that I've been informed enough on that. But on the general direction of a conservation type of program that we're going, whether it was a house bill that were considered or what's currently in what's in front of us in conferences, I think we've had enough hearings where there needs to be a conservation component. To what extent, I think will be developed here in the next hour. But 2113 is good, but I definitely like to see some testimony or some input from those who are going to be affected by it.
Okay, thank you. So I think this would be helpful if there's no questions right now. So look at this thing called the Arnold Zippel Bill, 3 acres. So this is a work in progress. Maybe Representative John P. Coonan or Marcourt want to talk to what's going on here. Does anybody, John P. Marcourt, Coonan, somebody want to jump in on this before staff? How do we arrive at this? Representative John P.
I was just reading through it. Yeah, this is a, yeah, I was just saying maybe somebody, there's Mark Order, Coonan, want to talk about the process that we even started getting to this point. Very well, then, Madam Chair, is just what we're trying to do, especially once the Senate hijacked the federal conformity bill of 3 acres. Arnold, we thought we needed to start bringing all of the skills and all of the input that we had heard together, so you know, we worked on a lot that had come out of Representative Junkie's committee and Bill, like Representative Hosh, and the work that Representative Conan and Demmer did last year and so forth, and after our hearing of March 17th and so forth. So the members I mentioned earlier, the six legislators, are working on, you know, how can we kind of bring all this together and get to some of these issues in with grandfather, the payback period, the transfer, the rural vacant land, all of that. So that's kind of the process, and we wanted to have some sort of, I guess, maybe a position, if you would call that, ready for this. And then also ready for the property tax division report that needs to come out on Monday.
Okay, so Mr. Hines, you want to just quick? And we don't have a bill for this, Senator. We're just trying to, we were trying to react to kind of you guys moving quicker, and even though we were hearing bills for hours and hours and hours, and we struggled in the House because we've heard from last year there wasn't enough hearings or enough time and enough transparency, and all of us that were a part of it know that that's not actually accurate, but that perception exists. We've got a timeline that we can pass around to remind everybody about the big, long, drawn-out open process that was over more than 1 year, but, you know, and we've been trying to have all this openness and transparency and live hearings, and I've listened to hours and hours of tapes and Junkies Committee and Ethan's Committee and you guys, you know, and we had a bunch in our property taxes and taxes, and so once you guys acted, then we felt we at least try to get our heads around where we might be going. So we don't have a bill, and we're not sure on any of these things, but I think if Mr. Hines can just help us start to just walk through some of these ideas, and I think you'll see we're probably closer than maybe the room realizes. Mr. Hines?
Yes, Madam Chair. The just quickly going through these points, that some of them may reflect a staff understanding that isn't necessarily exactly the same as the members who were there. We don't get the case in many places, there might be one or two, so feel free to tell us if you think we're wrong about this. But the first point is that the House Fund 2130 that you've been talking about. The second one, Rule 8090, was drawn prior to 5-1-2010 with no back taxes. Same with 7. Number 3, revert to 3-year back taxes on grandfathered rural vacant lands. Number 4, broaden the definition of non-productive land to include in Class 2A. So this is, again, similar to the Senate language about reviews and rock piles, the impractical, the soil separate, the road value separate. Number 5, this is a slight difference from the Senate. It allows CRP and non-permanent rim to qualify in the future. Representative Jumpy gave the rationale for why we're making a distinction between permanent and non-permanent land. Number 6, allows several vacant land to be withdrawn without all of it. Number 7, this is a point that was a memo from DOR about these, what we're calling sort of technical transfers, transfers to survive the spouse, etc. Make sure that that language is in there, that that doesn't trigger the forced withdrawal. Number 8, this may be the one where we're a little misunderstanding about exactly what we're saying, but grandfather rural vacant land could be transferred by the owner at the current time to anybody and still be enrolled in the program, so it could stay in. And then second, any time grandfather rural vacant land is transferred through a will or trust, it's allowed to remain in the to re-enroll in the program. So it could always be forever transferred through that mechanism, but current owners could transfer it once, just as a straight transfer or sale. Mm-hmm. Number 9, no back taxes if you donate land to a government agency or conservation organization. When we draw that issue and come up a couple of places of people who donated land and still got different back taxes. Number 10, across compliance, and this was say this is a kind of another part of the environmental piece that if a person enrolled in Green Acres was not compliant with all restrictions on what the pesticide and other water types of violations that they would be removed from the program. Number 11, this is to change future enrollments of Green Acres. So if you come in now, after the, from this point forward, putting in a stronger piece of commitment, a 12-year back tax instead of 3. And then finally, in number 12 is again one that there might be some concern about, but this would be a riparian buffer that we talked about 2113. It's adjacent to ag land, it gets to be in part 2A. So this would be not with the covenant requirement, but sort of that same kind of land without the covenant requirement that you get to pull that into Green Acres if you didn't want to meet the covenant. And that maybe is the one we discussed recently. So.
Okay, and one more piece. If we can get, do we have the documents showing the tax shifting that's going on in current law due to Green Acres? If we can get that passed up so everyone can see it tonight before we finish up, because I think we're making progress in understanding each other and we're not that far apart. The reason I just want House Conferees that Senator Scoy said under his breath to me, don't you people learn about the 7-year in reaction to the 12-year going forward. Okay, so we just want the House wants to explain why they would even consider that. Okay, so this is not about anyone who's in Green Acres now. It's not about people who have conservation lands in Green Acres. It's going forward, you know, for the future. And we want all the Senate conferees to take a look at this document. This is a really important document because, you know, this is where the ag folks and the conservation folks and the tax folks all start arguing. And that's why if you look at our conferees, we're a combo of those. And so Senator Scoy, Senator Bach, what we want you guys to see where we're coming from here. You know, our conferees are a blend of ag interests, conservation, tax. But for all the folks who weren't a part of this last year, what was the tax committee thinking? What were the tax conferees thinking? Well, this document reminds everybody what the tax conferees were thinking. I mean, what the tax conferees were thinking is that this program is paid for by other taxpayers. And so, if we want to preserve this program and go back to everybody who felt like they had a change, who was an enrollee, and address that one way, but if we want to go forward and say, okay, so if we solve the problem for everybody who's currently enrolled, what are we going to do for the future? We cannot forget there's major tax shifting going on, and all other property taxpayers are paying for it. I mean, that's the thing that the conferees, both bodies, cannot leave sight of here, and I think just having grandfathers and these kind of ideas are a significant, erosion of what folks did last year in the tax conference committee. Because people felt like they didn't have time, they didn't understand the rules changed, and I think we all learned through that process. But now going forward, if we take care of everybody in it now and say, what about the future? We all need to look at this chart. I mean, there are huge tax consequences for these programs. And so how much do we want to grow? We are shifting $55 million of property taxes from some people to others.
I'm sure.
And that's going to keep growing. So I just want, as we go forward, everyone has to think about what is the tax policy, and I'll get you in just a second, Senator Olson, and that is to say, it would be so much easier if we just had a big pile of money and the state just paid for this program. If the state paid for Green Acres and all the other property taxpayers in the jurisdiction didn't have to pay for the taxes, it'd be no problem. We had a big surplus, we could pay for it, and all these other taxpayers wouldn't pay for it. But the law, in fact, is that the state is not paying for this. Everybody who's got Green Acres, their neighbors are paying for it. And what makes it even to me a little more difficult from a tax perspective is the neighbors don't know it. And, so first of all, they're paying for it. Second of all, they don't know they're paying for it. And third, they have no one, if they ever figure it out, to hold accountable for it. So what are they going to do? Both their locally elected officials out of office, their locally elected officials didn't do this. Their city council members aren't taking votes to make this law or change these rules. Neither are their county commissioners. So once they figure it out that they're actually being asked to pay their neighbor's taxes, they can't go vote their locally elected officials out of office. So they can come to the legislature, and what do we do? Well, you know, that's all going on, locally, and we're not paying for that. And so it becomes kind of between the farmers and the assessors, and all the other property taxpayers are paying for the shift. And so we just have to be honest about that. Doesn't mean we shouldn't keep Green Acres or find an ultimate solution, but I think when we get to going forward, it is a really legitimate tax issue for the Minnesota legislature for all time. And that's kind of the core. We've got all these people disaffected now, and it mad at us. I get that, because I can get in all the house too. And I think we're going to find a good solution for all of it. But what about forever? What about for the future? Are we going to shift $100 million of property taxes on other people? $200, $300, $400? Are we ever going to try to limit it? And trying to say, let's put boundaries around the future. It might be a little more restrictive if it gives us time to have the tax debate. And we may decide, no, let's just stick with the way it was because we just can't take it politically. But I think this chart highlights what the problem really is at its core for future years.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're absolutely right. This is why we were working on Green Acres, because of the tax shift. The one thing I would say about when we look forward is if we do have different rules for the people who have the 35 to 33 counties or whatever it is that enroll after it, and what we do for those that enroll, we are treating Minnesotans differently. And that's one of the things that the Senate proposal does, is everybody gets treated the same no matter when they enroll in the county. And I think there's some value.
With the grandfather.
The grandfather goes away in 2000.
So you have it for 4 years. Yeah. Okay, so
how
can you react to all that, Representative?
Well, no, you're right. And first of all, just to the 33 counties that don't have it, some counties will never have it. They have no idea what we're talking about.
No, that's right.
Because all their tillable land is worth more than any of their already paid. If you don't have, and a lot of them don't have lakes, and they don't have a lot of rivers, when you get to southwest Minnesota, that's why you don't have any. It's not because they haven't been allowed in, or for some reason they're going to come in later, because they're not. They'll never have it. There are a couple counties, Todd County in particular, that I have to mention on behalf of Representative Tremont, and I don't know what we do with that, but I'm asking conferees and tax people here, their assessor has made the decision, we're not going to do it. I don't think by law. I think the Attorney General, in my opinion, who upholds state law, would have an action against that county for not allowing it. But that's a question that's on the table that we have to resolve here, too. We're getting an answer to Representative Trump if we can. But, you know, on the rest of it, again, Representative Stoy and Olstein and others, I think when you look at the Arnold Ziffel bill, I think a couple things that I think we can come to agreement on, too. You had a transfer on number 8 to relatives only. And again, we differ on that somewhat. I mean, why shouldn't Denver be able to sell this farm to me if I want to continue farming it, or you sell it to Fox? But only once. You get one transfer. And that should be written in there so you make sure you got your notes right. You're allowed one transfer to anyone. Unless it's by will, when you're not exchanging money, you can then you can transfer the green eight. That's what this was. But one, Beth, you want to comment to that?
Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
Well, the reason that I didn't do that is because it's an expansion of the program. From what they currently, when they signed up for Green Acres 30, 40, 20 years ago, there were four reasons that they wouldn't have to have a requalification if they did a transfer. It was for death, divorce, marriage, or transfer to a child. And so what we did is we went back to what was when they signed on the dotted line 20, 30,
right.
40 years ago.
Right.
Otherwise, it's an expansion.
Right. And Madam Chair, what we're saying now is going forward. I mean, we have heard through testimony. And it happens in my area, too, where the neighbor kid wants to take over the milking operation from the retiring farmer who doesn't have anyone there, and they want to re-enroll this, but he's not a relative. So why not allow one transfer if he agrees to the same conditions, so there's no, you know, no differences in the dollar values involved or the program leaders involved. And then that person who gets a transfer will have to make that decision, like you said, that from then on. They'll have to decide if they want to stay in the program under the new rules, or they're out, because they can't transfer yet. It's one transfer only. So to allow some of those relationships that are out there.
Okay, sorry to interrupt, Representative Junkie. So that's my both Representative Hodge and Demmer want to speak to that. Representative Hodge?
Well, on the transfer, I think we need to expand it from just son or daughter. I mean, the relationships out there are too many, especially in today's agriculture communities and the economies that we have. I have a lot of individuals who want to pass it on to their grandchildren because their children have decided not to farm, but others within the family want to. I think Green Acres is the agriculture preservation program, and if we want to preserve agriculture, it shouldn't matter who's doing the farming work, just as long as that continued use moves forward. So I think if they are able to abide by the regulations in Green Acres, it shouldn't matter who that property is transferred to. I strongly support.
And Representative Demmer to that, and then go back here and I'll Representative Tompkins and
other stuff. Thank you, I just wanted to be clear. Am I allowed one transfer in total, or am I allowed one transfer for each parcel? Say, for example, if I've got 150 acres, and I want to do 50 of it to each of my three children. Do I get a transfer each one of them because each parcel is one transfer, or do I only get one transfer and then the other?
Again, we can straighten that out. Some of those transfers will take care of at once. So you're doing trust and other things, all transfer, all done at one time. You know, you've got to change in the trust ownership.
On that, before we jump to Senator Stoy, can you, Representative Jackie, can you recall the story of Representative Hansen told us?
Yeah,
he said his parents had the farm, and then how did that work?
It was trust. I mean, they had set up in trust, and on the parents' side, now there's typically a filing and a transfer of ownership, but it's still the same people that own it, but now, you know, or the cousin bought the parents' share, but nothing's happened to the parcel. And what we're trying to get at is looking more at the parcel than the person. We're concerned about the parcel, not the person.
Okay, so Senator Stoy.
Well, Madam Chair, this transfer issue is really only an issue for the 4 years of your grandfather. Because after that, this land is going to be conforming to a program. I mean, and if you're a farmer and you're farming your land and you're doing whatever you have to do to be classified as 2A, then if somebody dies or they want to sell their land, they do that, and the owner goes in and gets Green Acres. It's an issue of being in conforming parcels. And if you're in the conservation program, so your homestead, Ag homestead, B, then you're in there, and that's got a covenant on it, which is transferable with the land. If you want to sell it, you transfer the covenant. I mean, you guys are getting hung up on transferring. Well, that shouldn't be an issue because your parcels will be conforming. And so whoever the new landowner is just goes in and signs up for the program because he's a conforming parcel. I think that the transfer is...
Madam Chair, just to that point, just that point of resistance. Yes, in your bill, that's true. We weren't looking at your bill. This is the Arnold Lincoln. This is Harold Zucker bill. So we're close. You're right. That's another way to handle it, but this would be another way to handle that besides the four-year grandfather. Everyone now has to. This would allow someone to stay in at the same program beyond 4 years. If you're transferred once, if you sold your farm to me, I could stay in it for 20 years, as long as the one transfer was allowed and I'd be there. So nothing would change.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the start, because it is pretty, kind of lays it right out there. But I was a county commissioner in Chautauqua County, and you know, when I would go to the planning commission and somebody was going to be selling their farmland to a developer, you know, people would come and testify that, oh, no, I like seeing the cows out in the pasture. I like seeing his woods there. They like it all, but they're not paying for it. So one of the things that I think this highlights is that, you know, everybody likes driving out in the country and seeing the scenic beauty and everything, but they're not paying for it. This way, it shows they actually are paying for it.
Yeah, that's exactly what the chart is.
But I mean, that is kind of nice to know, because I heard that so many times at the planning
commission. They're paying for it.
You know, yeah. We're not, you know, I like seeing the cows there. You know, I don't want to see houses there. Well, you know, they're paying a portion of it.
Yes, right? Yes. Anyone else? I do want to get one issue out before we, because we're kind of on a roll and we're making progress. I mean, to figure out a solution, everyone has to get their ideas out there and have to fight. And I think one thing we haven't hit on, and we need to spend a little time on, Senator Skoy, stop chuckling about County X, whatever. One thing I think we need to spend a little time on as a group here is thinking through the amount of phone calls we've all had and members have said, you know, well, I want to keep this for the farmer. And who is the farmer? And I've heard the whole kind of gamut on how do we do that from, you know, the OLA said let's not have an income limit, and that was because we didn't want, you know, think farmers tell people their income. The Senator for Restaurant Junkie and others have said, well, that's one way to show their farming. So how do we show their farming? Is it an income limit? Is it a homestead? I mean, how are we going to show? That's what we have to get to here. Are we going to have people have the homestead? Are we going to have people have an income limit?
Right.
How are we going to show that they're actually farming? I think as a group, we got to figure that out. So anybody in that sort of bucket should just jump in.
Madam Chair, we do understand that. I think that's an important piece. This is about ag land. First of all, we have to understand this wasn't, we're making it an ag preservation program. It's not a, you know, a development shelter land for development program. It's not what it is. And so the first thing I want to mention before I get to that, Madam Chair, is the other issue that we have to straighten out too, which is the number of years. And frankly, I'm trying to wake Vanderveer and Olcina down there, because this really pertains to you more than the rest of the city. And I know you're awake, Representative Vanderveer. We were both elected in 96.
Just waiting to get out of the credits and into the movie.
Yeah. But one of the things we really have to seriously discuss, if you're serious about setting this aside and that being a shelter for the next Walmart or strip mall, then the length of years does make a difference.
Yeah.
Because it's Walmart, or I'm using Walmart, it could be anyway. If some large box store is going to buy that property, a three-year payback is nothing. A five-year, seven-year is nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So you're really sheltering your land. So we have to talk about that length of time.
Representative Junkie, if I may.
Yeah, please. Because I know it affects, frankly, you're the more highly developable, highly valued. When you look at this chart and see what your land values are compared to some other counties, this does affect you immensely.
And Senator Olcina, this is good. We want to hear where you're at this, because I want to back up Representative Junkie here in that, you know, the collar counties, the program is working to kind of be a speed bump on the way to development. If you look at the map, and this is what the Office of the Legislative Auditor said, the collar counties, you could argue that the farmers are not getting enough tax benefits and they should get significantly more because they're still ultimately developing. So if you look at kind of the land tracts in the seven counties, the collar counties, it's not stopping the lands from getting developed. It's just people are getting it until they ultimately sell or their kids sell or someone else does. So, you know, we do need to figure that out. So, Senator Olstein, thoughts on...
Well, here's my spiel. I've done it many times. That in our neck of the state, say the average farm is a 160-acre farm. And because of the lie of the land, there may be 80 acres tillable, there may be a 40-acre wetland, and then there may be 40 acres of high woods. So really, only half the farm may be productive land. But the thing that I've liked more about Rod's proposal with the Conservation Conservancy as this goes on is they would keep the productive land in Green Acres, and then they could put the rest of it into the conservation or covenant. You know, then they're setting it aside, you know, and the nice part about this is that if they decide, well, we're going to sell the land in a couple of years, well, then they can pull it out of Green Acres with no payback. But if they say it's a century farm, we're going to keep it in the family, they put it in the covenant, and then...
Okay, so, Senator Olstein, we've got a big reaction from the House conference there because I think that proves the point that it's not going to stop them from selling it when they want to and developing it, and then public tax dollars have gone... And this mechanism, and it's only slowed it down so they're ready to develop it. Which the point is that it's not supposed to develop. Senator Olstein.
But that 8-year covenant makes a difference because at this point they can decide, well, geez, are we going to keep it in the family or not? But if they're going to, then they sign up for the covenant and it's at least 8 years. It's ongoing beyond that.
Senator Scoyan, you know, Rep. Jones here or anyone else can jump in here, but I think that works on the covenant land but doesn't work on the ag land and they still sell. So, Senator Scoyan.
Well, I'll just give you my rationale from last year on the survey. And it's pretty simple. These landowners are all mostly farmers. And they probably haven't lived very well. And the only thing they asked for an asset was their land. And I thought, what the heck, when they finally got to sell it, why 10 lines? And I just said 3 years. And I didn't see any reason to make any change from what they signed up for 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, Senator, Rep. John here couldn't help me out here. I thought we were talking about folks going forward, not people currently in, but going forward, and I think that's why we're arguing for longer here.
Well, Madam Chair, I think we need to resolve fundamentally if we're going to treat Minnesota differently. And I don't think we should. I really don't think we should. If somebody owns land that meets the criteria, and they happen to be in Bell County or in Bambi, why should we treat them differently? I can't see why we should.
Senator Vandiver.
Madam Chair, I view it a little differently. I don't view it as this costing us money. What we have many classes, some we favor, some we don't. This is a favorite class that we're allowing them to choose to be in, granted. But other than that, it's no different than homestead or other things that we do. If we want to encourage and make available farmland, especially from my standpoint in the metro area, if we want to protect that way of life and allow them to stay in business until they decide to get out of it, then there's no way they can pay the tax on it as if it was residential or something else. So what this allows is them to continue their business until they decide to sell it. I don't look at it as getting this money back being a requirement any more than we go back and chase people when they sell their house and try and get their homestead credit back. We want to encourage people to own their own home. In the same way, we want to encourage this land to remain in agricultural use if it's in agricultural use, because we benefit from the open space, we benefit from the access that we have to it, you know, to go out and ride horses and do whatever we want to do, and we get the benefit of the, you know, the green space and all that. So it's, you know, there's benefits to it, but really it's protecting that way of life. They cannot function if we take away this lower tax rate. They're simply going to have to sell it.
Well, you know, when we go, a lot of people go back to, you know, you have to live up to the intent of the contract they sign. But the intent of that law that was signed back in the 1960s was ag preservation. And I don't think you can compare it to a homestead house, because I can't sell my homestead house for 60 or 100 or 1,000 times what the land is worth. I mean, that's what Representative Junkie is saying, and I even saw it near Dilworth where a Walmart came in and they sold, it was like $100,000, $200,000 per acre. It was a huge amount, and that's what's happening, especially in your area.
To that point, Madam Chair. you know, you're not buying this house. It's $100 a year shift on a $200,000 property, maybe. You're not buying it. You're getting your way for a while with it. The state is by preferring this plant. If you want to buy this land and keep it a certain way, well, feel free to do that. But this isn't, we're not buying it from these people. And so why act like we they have to pay it back or like we did buy it? We're just encouraging that use. And that's a little bit different than saying, well, you know, the homestead is a preferred plant. We've decided that we want that to continue, so we have a lower rate on it. Isn't that correct? And don't we do that in a number of other things? And to me, this is just a lower class. If you want to buy it, buy it. That's a different deal.
Well, yeah, the homestead, I still don't think, I think it's not the correct comparison. But, I mean, the bottom line is, how do you balance from ag preservation to, as Representative Junkie said, a shelter until you can develop it for millions of dollars? I mean, and that's the crux, I think, of the question. How do you balance that? And is 3 years of back taxes, I mean, is that really a penalty if you're able to sell that property for a huge amount?
And you just understand that. I'm not worried that someone's going to sell. They're going to sell their property eventually unless the state buys it. And we think we're buying up most of the land that we get our hands on. But, you know, they are going to eventually sell it. There's nothing you can do. And the question is, do you want farming to continue in the suburban rings and in different parts of the state? If you do, you have to give them the tax break. If we take this all away, you're not going to have to worry about them selling. They're going to lose it to the bank, or they will sell it and because they can't farm it. Not when the taxes are more than the payment usually. So I don't see where you're giving them anything per se, other than telling them you'll tax them at this lower rate. I don't see why you feel you're losing something.
I mean, no one's suggesting we're taking away the Green Acres program. I mean, that's not what we're talking about here. But I think it's a very legitimate question in how do you balance the original intent of the law, which is ag preservation, and granted, you might argue, even though in the ring power counties that you've lost a lot of ag land, you might have lost a lot more had it not been for Green Acres. I will say that, but I think you're probably right. But we're still losing that land, and how do you kind of balance that? And maybe what Representative or Senator Scoy has, the conservation—that's I think one approach you could use, but. I just think that TVAC period and covenants might all play into that.
Madam Chair, just to change the subject slightly again, something else on the table, referring to the, following up for what Senator Olstein and Senator Feinwell, conservation plan, one of the other issues they're putting my appraiser slash assessor type hat back on, you know, in your bill, it says that you value that land. The bill says market value, excluding development pressure, et cetera, limited to tillable land. But the problem with that is how do you come up with that value? We don't have a methodology developed for that. Again, we're confusing assessors again. There's no agreement on how to value that for non-productive land. So now, again, you haven't taken care of that totally. And I know that's a technical kind of question, but that is one of the problems when we go to the conservation plan. There's no methodology that assessors currently would have to value that land, even based on the language you put there. So, I mean, it's something we have to work on between today and tomorrow, and I just want to put that on the table so that people are aware of that going forward.
I know to represent Demery and then Senator Scoy, but I think it seems like we're going backward, but we're actually not. We're going forward because, and we're going to try to adjourn pretty quickly here, but people have to put out what they disagree, and everybody's doing that, so that's good. We can't forget that we agree on a lot of stuff here, or it's very close. So we do, Senator Bach and I want to get this bill wrapped up tomorrow. That means that everybody who's got, you know, input needs to be talking and finding each other, and, you know, we're doing everything in public, on the tape, but, you know, time is of the essence because it's Thursday night, tomorrow night, so, and Senator Bach will have to gavel, but we want to go to everybody else who has something to say here before we try to wrap up. Representative Demmer.
Just to that point, Madam Chair, Representative Junkie talked about this. I did have in my bill did call for the Department of Revenue to come up with a methodology for valuing, for coming up with Green Acres value on the grandfathered rural vacant land. There is a methodology right now, it's arbitrary, it's a percentage of something other, but just to throw that out, I think that is a point, I want to get on record, I think it's important that we come up with something. You know, they, and I don't know if the Department of Revenue has all the smarts, but they got more than I got, I know that. So, in my bill, I basically said that I charged the Department of Revenue to come up with some sort of a plan, like they did with the ag land, for saying what is the community's valuation on the rural vacant. And I think it's important that we come up with something like that.
Thank you, Representative Demetriou.
Well, the value of the 2B land would be the value prescribed by the Commissioner of Revenue for Class 2A. So that's what it is. And then what we do is, because I think ag land has a range of value, we go down to the bottom and determine the value for ad valorem tax purposes shall not consider the presence of commercial, industrial, residential, seasonal recreational land uses that may affect the value of the real estate clients and subdivision. I think that ag value has separate different values depending upon where it is on the farm, and I wanted to give this language in there so the assessor could have determined a range, and I don't have the last endorsement, but I think it says a little greater there. So it's the value of the class 2A.
Right. No, I understand that, but I mean, there's all those other factors. I think we're setting up, I'm just classic instant here. So I want these investors to weigh in on this, too, if it's clear how they're going to value this, because that's one of the problems we had with the old bill, was the assessors and not being clear enough on what the law was and how they implement it. So I'm just putting out mainly for them, too, to weigh in before tomorrow on how your conservation piece would be able to be valued very clearly and by formula or some way, like Representative Demmer just said, that there's got to be a real... Yours, you list all the reasons and the different ways it could be valued. You list the range, but again, we're setting this up for interpretation differently by different folks.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think for 90% or more of the ag land, we could just use the 2A total property, because as I said earlier, the policy fits just fine. When you get inside to this smaller suburbs or area, you are going to have some of the low value non-tillable lands. That's going to have a significantly lower value than the A land. And I thought that we should give them a mechanism to establish a range of values, so if it was a small swamp or something, they could actually put a little lower value on that than the 2A tillable property. And that's kind of a hard thing to write out in words, but that's right. What we were headed for.
I think your intent is good, but again, it's just something we need to make sure we're clear on tomorrow going ahead of this bill.
Okay, we're into the wrap-up now. Does anybody have anything else they want to throw out there? Because this is good. We've got all the conferees sort of weighing in. Anybody else want to throw anything out so we can all dream about Green Acres? Anybody? Nobody. That's good. Okay, so why don't we... I'm going to read this note here for a minute. Okay, so I think we want to hear what Senator Bach thinks about tomorrow. This is a bad time for everybody because we're all at policy deadlines and all the committee rooms are closed. So, members, we want to hear from Senator Bach a little bit so everyone in the room can just kind of get a feeling for where we're going tomorrow. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, the Senate recently passed new rules, joint rules, that the House, I believe, has not taken up. The new rules, when they're passed by the House, will require the location of the gavel and conference committees every day, excluding Sunday and holidays. The old rules don't talk about that. So I just can tell you, I guess I'm going to get the gavel. And if people want to get serious and resolve this, I'm willing to do that. If not, Senator Cohen will probably be happy because I'm not going to spend $15 million in this biennium. And frankly, I don't feel a strong desire to do anything on Green Acres. I mean, I thought we did pretty good work last year. So I guess it
it doesn't matter to me. We're spending a lot of time talking about a bunch of stuff that's not in the bill, that stuff that's not even been introduced, bills that have been introduced and never heard anywhere. And, Madam Chair, tomorrow night I'm going home. And I'm going to spend the weekend with my family, and I'm not going to call a meeting tomorrow and still be sitting here at 7:30 tomorrow night playing footsie with people. Okay? Straight up. So if people between now and tomorrow morning want to decide if they want to meet tomorrow, I'm willing to meet tomorrow if we're going to do something constructive. If we're not, then let's all go home. And people can think about it over the weekend whether they want to do anything on conformity or if they want to do anything on Green Acres. I don't have a strong feeling either way. It'd be nice if we could. But if we can't get there, well, the world's not going to end. Senator Cohen will be happy, and that's one of my good friends. And we're $15 million means something right now. So that's just kind of where we're at, Madam Chair. So people that are having all this discussion back and forth, I want to continue to have that later tonight and early tomorrow morning. People want to get it done maybe in an hour and a half, 2 hours tomorrow. I'm willing to meet tomorrow afternoon to do that. We post a meeting tomorrow morning sometime, but I think people need to sleep on whether we really want to get some work done or not. If we do, I'm willing to meet tomorrow afternoon. I think we can probably get room 118 over in the Capitol. I think we can probably get it about 4 o'clock if people are interested in doing that. So I think maybe over the course of the night, people can figure out if they're interested in doing that or not. But I do have plans for the weekend with my family, and it involves going home tomorrow night. So.
Well, I appreciate knowing where you're at, Senator Bach. I guess I'd ask the Conferees as a group, does everyone think they can work out Green Acres in a couple hours tomorrow? I mean, I think we know our colleagues want us to. That means the grand compromise must take place quickly. I think we had a good discussion to be able to understand each other, but everyone's got to give here now. I mean, everyone's got to give here now, or as Senator Bach just said, it's okay with the 2008 change.
I'm sure.
So I think people got to get motivated. People got to get motivated.
I think that you're right, that we are closer than it appears. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. Others? Does everybody think this is doable in a couple hours tomorrow?
We're really close.
Compromise means everybody has to give something up. That's what a compromise is. Okay, so anything else? We're going to look for Mr. Rundquist or Ms. Aldrich's email telling us when we're room and time. Looks like maybe about 4-ish. And so with that, thank you, everybody. We got through everything, and we are adjourned.